Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 270 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host. Hold on. Let me put on my COVID mask. I've got this sweet Dudes and Beer COVID mask that one of our biggest listeners, actually, shamefully enough, my brother Randy Jordan sent it to me. So I was like, dude, anybody who's willing to send me a branded Dudes and Beer mask to keep the COVID out, that's awesome. So thanks, listener. While you're online checking everything out, where you can get your own branded COVID mask, ladies and gentlemen, stop on by podcastcadet.com. That is our new sponsor. Podcastcadet.com is there to help you start your own podcast. If you already have a podcast going, they're there to help you take it to the next level. They provide one-on-one counseling, everything from WordPress design to how to operate WordPress to designing your podcast, naming your podcast, branding your podcast, distributing your podcast, monetizing your podcast. Whether you're starting a podcast for yourself, your friends, family, fun, church, business, doesn't really matter. Podcastcadet.com is the place for you. Stop on by today. Dudes20 is the code for you to save 20% off your entire cart. Tonight's episode, so incredibly awesome. I am so excited. I cannot wait. We've got our good friend Mike Turber from 5x5 News coming on here in just a few minutes. I will be connecting with him during our sound clip segment here in just a moment. But he is coming on to discuss some bombshell new stuff regarding 9/11. From what I understand, this news is actively breaking tomorrow on mainstream news wires. So keep your ears out, folks. But this is a hot, hot episode tonight. Three great hot button topics. First off, we will be hearing from our good friend J.L. Carpenter from J.L. Carpenter Law in Houston regarding the use of Zoom for court. They are actively talking about using Zoom for picking juries as well as jury trial here in the great state of Texas and states beyond. So that was a very important story whenever I saw it post yesterday. So I was like, I've got to get her on and talk for a few minutes. So we've got JL coming on to talk about that. Then we will be having Mike Turber come on to talk about the new Space Force. I've got my Space Shuttle Operator's Manual here. We're going to get uber geeky tonight. There are all kinds of files over on the Dudes and Beer website. If you head over there, folks, you can see our link for tonight's post has tons of hot links. I've got all the tabs open. We're going to be going through them. We've got tons of declassified documents to talk about. We're going to be talking about the X-37B, which is, of course, the new poster child for the U.S. Space Force. But, like, it's not new, people. It's been here for years, like well over a decade, and flying over our heads, sometimes for 2 years at a time on the same mission, secret missions, all kinds of stuff. We've got the propulsion documents here. We've got like layouts for that craft, plus derivative craft, other craft that have been based off of it, other craft that it was based off of, all kinds of stuff, all in the Dudes and Beer Knowledge Vault for tonight's episode, as well as documents regarding Gopher 6, the call sign for the C-130 Hercules, that apparently witnessed some pretty major stuff on 9/11. So we will be getting into all that with our great guest, Mike Turber, here in just a few minutes, right after this quick report from our guest, J.L. Carpenter with J.L. Carpenter Law. We have on the phone with us right now, J.L. Carpenter, lead attorney for J.L. Carpenter Law and Associates. J.L. Carpenter Law is the website. How are you doing today, J.L.?
I'm well. How are you, Chris?
Doing great. Thank you so much for always coming on, discussing these legal things that are going on in our society, especially right now during this COVID moment that we have going on.
Unprecedented times.
It's really interesting. And, you know, you and I, last time you were on the show, all of this had just kind of started.
Right.
And we were talking about how There were headlines all over the place about prisoners being released. And people are like, oh, my God. And it's like, you know, this isn't people like in prison, folks. This is people in like county jail that by the time the quarantine is over will not have seen their day in court and they cannot be legally held. so, like, you can't violate people's rights during these quarantines like that. So they had to release people. But there was a very interesting article that I posted on the Dudes and Beer website over the weekend. That I texted you about and was like, check this out. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I'm in Houston, Texas. So we're in Harris County, which is one of the largest counties, both geographically and by population mm-hmm. in the state of Texas. And so you had sent me the article that you had put on your website about doing jury trials by Zoom. And at the same time, I had just gotten a survey by Harris County that they said to the lawyers for our thoughts and our ideas and feelings about having jury trials via Zoom. So it kind of all came together at the right moment. And I thought, I need to call Chris and discuss this.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, of course, there was the big kerfuffle a few weeks ago about Zoom meetings being hacked. People Zoom bombing, that kind of stuff. And that was typically because people were either not setting their meeting to private and password protected, or they were using continuous passwords. They were using the same meeting over and over and over and over and over. And that got passed through email chains over and over and over, and somebody's email got hacked. And boom, there you have it. Of course, yeah. The court system will be following a much more strict guideline with that security protocol, I'm sure. But even in the discussion with my wife last night, you know, like whenever I saw the article, I was like, check it out. Like I was telling you, this may be the way it goes because this might be the only way that we can continue the court system and give people their trial on time.
Maybe, but here's the thing. You know, you and I've discussed before how I feel like you win or lose a case in jury selection.
Sure.
And that's where I really put a lot of emphasis in my trial work. But as a criminal defense attorney, most cases do not actually go to a jury trial. The benefit of this whole situation has been that I think that judges and staff and attorneys have realized that we don't necessarily have to all be at the courthouse every day to get something done.
Yeah.
The Zoom appearances that we're doing in front of the bench, we're getting a lot done electronically, and we're not having to drive an hour into town, an hour back, go through security.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a lot of work on everybody mm-hmm. to physically appear when it can be done electronically. So that's the benefit that everyone's realizing. There are more efficient ways to handle our day-to-day tasks than to physically have to go be in the courtroom. However, when it comes to a jury trial, and many times I set things for a trial just to get the prosecutor's attention because they're overwhelmed. They have a lot of cases. And so it takes looking at it from a trial perspective. Is this a winner or a loser? What are my issues with this case to get a dismissal?
Yeah.
So I'll set something for trial thinking it's never going to trial. I just need the prosecutor's attention to get rid of it because they haven't looked at it seriously enough because they're overwhelmed, right? So many times you'll have jurors come down and they'll be standing in the hallway waiting to come into the courtroom for jury selection. And then the bailiff comes out and says, thank you. Your presence here has been able to resolve the case and you're no longer needed. Which is horrible that it takes that to get a case either dismissed or a proper resolution, whether it's, you know, a plea negotiation that everyone can live with or whatnot. But, if it's a case where truly, the client is adamant, they want their day in court, they want their trial, and the prosecutor has a different perspective and is not willing to work the case out or dismiss it, then those are the cases that actually go to trial. And when they do, I think that it is way too serious of a situation when your liberty and your justice is at stake for you to do this electronically. And the reason I say that is because a couple of things. First of all, not everybody who's out there that's a potential juror has a computer and the means to appear by
Zoom. Right.
So you're eliminating that class of folks that would typically be in the courtroom. And then let's say they come down to the courthouse in person and everybody's wearing masks. Well, I can't judge everybody's facial expressions if half their face is covered in a mask, right? And you probably can't hear very well, which is another issue. So you might not get clear answers. But if you're doing everything via Zoom, that really takes a step away from being able to relate to these folks. And again, when I'm picking juries, I'm looking for somebody who can be fair and impartial and listen to all the evidence before making a decision. People bring experience with them from day-to-day life to the courtroom. And so let's say I'm defending someone who's accused of burglarizing a home, and I've got a juror out there who just had their home burglarized. That's probably not going to be someone who can be fair and impartial on this jury. And I have to be able to, you know, ferret these things out, find out who are the good jurors for this particular case and who should probably not be on that jury. And that's very hard to do via Zoom, electronically, without being in the physical presence of these potential jurors.
And I will make the common man's analogy here. I used to have a really good friend who ended up moving and going to be like a cooler at a casino as a card player, where he would literally come in when somebody was winning, and he was the one that would come in and kind of whittle them down on behalf. but he did a lot of online gambling, and I was like, how can you even do that? Three quarters of the game of poker is playing the player, not even the cards in your hand.
True.
And and so much of the courtroom is the same way. It is the body language of the jurors whenever they are responding and hearing testimony, whenever, you know, and to see that Brady Bunch style on a screen.
Well, and, you know, the jurors are sizing up the lawyers and the client as soon as they walk in.
Well, and vice versa, exactly. You don't have that vibe when you walk in the room. You don't have that physical presence. Yeah.
We're sizing them up when they walk in, you know, and there's little things I look for. For instance, many times jurors will bring books with them to read during the time that they're not doing anything. I want to know what they're reading. I look to see what books they're reading, what they're holding on to. You know, I look at, you know, purses and shoes, and they're looking at us to see if we have fancy watches. And, you know, so there's just so much that you do during that jury selection that is just not going to be practical during if jury selection is done via Zoom, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I think you could do the jury selection. Are they talking about selections via Zoom as well?
Yeah.
Oh, everything. Wow. See, I didn't realize that it was the selection. I figured, you know, like jury trial. Okay. You don't need an audience. Cool. That means you get to remove the media from the courtroom. Beautiful. and that means that now it's, you know, and I could utterly understand the issues, like we were saying, the poker face, being able to read body language of the jury and even of the prosecutor, things like that. But with that few people, you're talking bailiff, judge, prosecutor or prosecutors, defense attorneys, defendant, you know, the rest of everybody else who would be sitting a foot apart from each other can all be via Zoom. But if they're talking about jury selection via Zoom, yeah, man, that's a world different.
Well, some of the alternative suggestions that came up in the survey was bringing in smaller jury pools so that way there's more distance between everybody.
Sure. Yeah,
but again,
exactly.
they want everyone to wear masks, including the parties, the lawyers. And so the other is bringing them in one at a time. Well, in the state of Texas, typically you only have jury selection one potential juror at a time in a death penalty case. Otherwise, everybody is in a group. Now, the reason I like everybody in a group is because there might be somebody out there who was falsely accused of domestic violence, and I'm defending somebody of a domestic violence charge. And that person may tell his experience and the other jurors can, you know, listen to that and we can have a full discussion. So you don't get that if it's one-on-one. But, you know, we tried a case in April of, I think it was last year at this point, that was a capital murder. We got a mistrial, hung jury, and we were scheduled to retry it this year. It got bumped now, I think, to September. But because of the high publicity in that case, we're going to need like 300 potential jurors to get over the publicity.
Yeah.
There's no way that 300 citizens are going to be willing to come down to the courthouse under these circumstances and be shoulder to shoulder in the same courtroom, hustled from elevators, you know, through the they're not going to want to subject themselves to that. And and I understand why. But then that also means that we may not get a jury trial until next year.
Like we were saying last time you were on, this has definitely caused a kerfuffle in the legal community, in the legal system. But at the same time, where it's going now with the technology and everything else, it's really interesting to see how the legal system may change in a few ways.
Right. And I think that, you know, without us having to spend an hour driving into town, an hour back, you know, and then the time that we sit in court, I think that if we have, as lawyers, both sides, prosecution and defense, more office time, then maybe we might be able to settle, move, dismiss, negotiate these more of these cases without the need to take up the court's resources for a jury trial.
Exactly, exactly. And that, and I think if anything, we may be unburdening the legal system, the jail system, the prison system in a lot of ways because of this. You as a defense attorney know a lot of people end up getting a rap that they really shouldn't get. We've said it before, there are numerous juvenile cases, things like that, where, you know, it really could have been dismissed. It really could have been let go. And now somebody has something dogging them for the rest of their life. And to know that this may be a light of hope, in some of those cases is actually a great thing. But like you're saying, to know that it's also going to cause some issues with jury trials. Man, like it's so interesting to see how this crisis has brought us to so many turnabouts that may be good and may be bad. To see it affecting the legal system like this and to see changes being affected in the legal system like this is great and also at the same time a little frightening in some ways. So. Thank you so much for taking the time, as always, JL, to come on.
My pleasure.
Talk about issues facing our country, facing our rights, things like that. Let everybody know where they can go to procure your services, should they be in need of them, anything like that.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. It's jlcarpenterlaw.com, jlcarpenterlaw.com. We're in Houston, practice in Harris County, Galveston, Fort Bend, Brazoria County, all the surrounding counties around Houston, Texas, always available, 713-201-6767. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on as always, JL. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Chris.
JL Carpenter, we love having her on the show, being able to break down what's going on in the law, how to protect our rights, how to keep our families out of the system and how to keep ourselves out of the system. And really just, you know, kind of keeping an eye on, like I said, all of our rights, all of our constitutional goodness that we have in this country. Speaking of constitutional goodness that we have in this country, one of the things that is constitutional is our military. One of the things that is not is NASA. But what's very interesting is the launch of the Space Force this year.
Space. Going to be a lot of things happening in space. Because space is the world's newest warfighting domain. Amid grave threats to our national security, American superiority in space is absolutely vital. And we're leading, but we're not leading by enough, but very shortly we'll be leading by a lot. The Space Force will help us deter aggression and control the ultimate high ground. With today's signing, I will proudly appoint General J. Raymond, the first Chief of Space Operations, and he will become the very first member of the Space Force, and he will be on the Joint Chiefs. He will be on the Joint Chiefs, which are now expanding by one position. That's a very powerful position. So, General Raymond, congratulations, and thank you for everything you've done.
And there you have it. That was the official announcement of the Space Force by our standing president right now, Mike Turber, 5x5 News. Welcome to the show. As we connected this evening, you were like, hey, I know we're talking about these two topics, but the bombshell that I was texting you about was actually stuff going on with the Vegas shooting. So three topic show tonight with Mike. Love it.
Yep.
Always love our conversations. How have you been doing, my friend?
I'm doing excellent. Actually, I am at this moment probably in one of the best positions I have been in a long, long time, and it is incredibly refreshing. Yes.
It is not due to your lack of work and effort on behalf of 5x5 News that you have been getting the attention that you're getting from people like Dr. Michael Sala at ExoPolitics, people at Mysterious Universe, people even at Popular Mechanics, man.
Right.
Calling up, talking to you about the Tic Tac, the gimbal, the fast mover, UAPs. I almost said UFOs. UAPs.
Yeah, you can say it. Yeah. I still say UFOs. I'm old school, buddy. I still do the same thing.
I just can't buy UFOs on them. Not after everything that we've talked about. Not after
right.
You know, like UFO to me is extraterrestrial full on. It's what it is.
Yeah.
It's not really what either one of us make this out to be. We've been pulling the line since the beginning that they very much seem like operated drones. They very much seem like our technology. And go ahead.
I'll never forget the first UFO story. And see, I get to say it. Nanny, nanny, boo, boo. The first UFO story that I recall ever having been so intrigued was the Barney and Betty Hill Barney and Betty Hill story, you know, and that one always stuck with me, and I almost like I could remember the story almost verbatim. And then of course I got into that, and then I got away from it because, you know, I'm super debunker this and all this other stuff, and that kind of was like a taboo area for me. And then, you know, of course, going to the Air Force, I get out of the Air Force, and then I go into all these other areas of, you know, some people looking at my life would probably think that there's no way a single human being could have done all these crazy things. But here I am. So, and here we are tonight. How are you, Chris? How have you been?
I've been doing okay, man. Amid the madness, you know, not doing too bad, looking kind of COVID chic here on the camera, you know? Really, like I was saying, this whenever we started talking about this episode, as things were launching this last week, all that kind of stuff,
right,
for Space Force, I was like, you know, we really need to do an episode about the poster child of the Space Force, the X-37B.
Right.
Because they've been touting it and touting it, touting it all over the news. The space plane. Man, you know, how many people do you know that whenever you mention it, know the fact that that thing has been flying over our head in active mission since at least 2008?
Very few actually know that information. Plus, I think it had, I think one of the missions was a little over 2 years or 780 days, I think it came out to.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah. I just brought up on screen right now, and just for those of you at home, you can follow along. All the episodes that we have with people like Dr. John Hall, you know, Graham Phillips, stuff like that, Mike Turber, always lead eventually to Knowledge Vault documents. And this one led to like 8. I think it may have been a record show where once you started telling me about things, I started rabbit holing, and I spent like an entire day just going through stuff, just rabbit hole, and finding documents and things like that. Like one of them that I found, if you go to dudesandbeer.com, /knowledge will get you there. /declassified will get you to the declassified government documents and programs section. And you'll see all the top ones there are stuff pertaining to tonight down to the 9/11 commission. But one of those documents is quite literally the NASA fact sheet on X-37 technology demonstrator blazing the trail for the next generation of space transport systems. That is 2003.
Yep. That's absolutely. So, the weird thing is that when you look at this, obviously it's a miniature space shuttle when people look at it, and it has derived a lot of the technology that came over from that.
Yeah.
And obviously, if there's an X-37B, naturally the first thought is there an A? Was there a first one? Was there going to be a C? There's all kinds of different thoughts that go back and forth about how the X-37 is operated. And now the X-37 has made its official transition from the Air Force to Space Force, which is just kind of like changing something from the Navy to the Marines. It's like a virtually identical situation. Yeah. So it's going to remain under that same umbrella.
Or back in the day, going from the Army to the Air Force.
Right.
Before it was full on a separate branch. And I have up right now on screen the article from U.S. Air Force AF.mil, Air Force.military, X-37B breaks record, lands after 780 days in orbit.
Right.
Do the math, folks. That's 2 years of unassisted flight in space. And if you go through and start reading that X-37 document that I brought up a while ago, you will see the fact that it was actively made specifically to test propulsion systems, things like that, in space. That was one of the main directives of the program itself. So,
absolutely, and the thing about it, the X-37 is a good workhorse. You have to wonder, what is it doing for 780 days? And naturally, there's quite a bit going on with that. The Space Force is going to be essentially, it's not a major transition. It's not at all. It's basically you're taking the 14th and you're pushing it into something that allows it to have a little bit more freedom and things of that nature. So, you have a lot of different wings and flights basically a lot of the different functions of the space surveillance network, if you want to call it that, with the Air Force and with various agencies like the National Reconnaissance Office, National Geospatial, portions of NSA, even dropping into the civilian world, you may have some CIA requests that go in there. Naturally, you'll have some other requests. Well, you might even have the FBI asking for some favors here and there. But the Space Force, the good thing about it is by branching that off, you're going to get a lot more efficiency out of the organization. Pretty much the same reason why the Marines the Marines is just like how space Marines are to Navy as Space Force is to Air Force. So basically, it's the same thing, or a similar type of apparatus. I think there's around 16,000 or so people that are working inside of Space Force. I can tell you right now that number is obviously not real. It's much higher than that.
And even if you go here, just so you guys know, I am actively thumbing through my space shuttle operator's manual right now. And if you go to payloads over here, there's a whole chapter on the payload bay and everything. And just so you are aware, the payload bay of the STS, the shuttle transport system, was actively asked to be enlarged by the reconnaissance office.
Correct.
So that it would be able to fit their spy satellites.
I got some good stories to tell you about that.
And one of the things that I brought up earlier, let me see if I can bring it back up real quick. I'm hopping back over to my computer on the screen here. But if you look, folks, you can actually see all of the declassified missions. There is right here just a short list of the declassified missions on space.com, and there's probably about 15 of them that were classified Department of Defense, things like that, where they went up, were launching satellites that were too big for Atlas rockets, things like that. And even right now I have on screen the article that came up a few days ago talking about the X-37B launching on a new mystery mission. Space Force launches. Like I said, it is the new poster child for our Space Force. And there's even the bring back around of the Space Force flag and the logo. And it's like, hey, man, Space Command's been using that since they went to Cheyenne Mountain.
That's true.
Since they started tracking little objects in the sky, all over the sky, they've been using that symbol. Mm-hmm. This is really just an offshoot of Space Command that now has tactical purpose.
Right.
Outside,
there'll be some questions as to whether or not Star Trek and Space Command and Space Force, because if you look at all these patches and everything, yeah, and you know, they're somebody, I don't know who took it from who, but it's quite
clear. It's pretty out there. Like, it's right there.
It is.
You know,
it's awesome. It's awesome.
Even the fact of, if you go and look at the National Federation or the Federation of Planets logo, mm-hmm, looks very similar to the logo of the UN.
Right.
And so there's, yeah, definitely derivative of all this stuff. And even speaking of derivatives, the article the document that I have up right now, AIAA 2011-7315, is from Long Beach Research Center, California, talking about the X-37B and its derivatives. This is directly from Boeing. And if you watch here, folks, let's just... Yeah, all these little abbreviations you see here, AFRL, ALTV, APAS, BRI, CADS, CBM, it's literally an alphabet soup of, let's see, like most of these are things that they are built of, but if you start going through, like, you will start finding, like, low Earth orbit, everything else, and it's literally... all the different programs. There are about 20 or 30 different derivatives of this plane that have been used over time.
Right.
This is just the latest version. I'm sure that there are numerous versions after that are being worked on as well. So, you know.
Well, there are some variants. You have the X-37A initial variant. The C in 2011, I believe, that was a scaled-up version. It's you know, yeah, they were going to build it to make it a larger variation. I think that one got side canned a little, yeah, bit. Yeah. And then you've got, you know, obviously other X projects and what have you, and then of course we can go all the way to Tic Tac and back. You know, Tic Tac and back. That's a good rhyme there.
Yeah, right.
So all of these different subjects, you know, there's some interesting things that came out of this. And when you mentioned that space shuttles, SST bay was yeah, basically made larger so it could carry different payload and what have you. You know, the shuttle was a workhorse. Obviously, it was made to, you know, get the cost of going to space lower. And that, you know, turned out to not be the case. And you had the two losses. I was actually on top of a building in Hong Kong when we lost, when you had a Challenger go down, and you had, you know, then you have Columbia, and then you had Challenger went first, and you know, we know all that story. One of the interesting stories is you have Hubble that just did its 30th anniversary, and it was really only supposed to last for 10 years. But anyone looking at Hubble would, and I think I mentioned this before, but may have some new listeners, but it's pretty interesting story. I'm off the screen. So the question is, why would you build one when you can build three?
Yeah.
Are you still with me?
Yep, yep.
Yeah, I'm just making sure someone was trying to call in, and I have to hang up.
Yeah, I don't
care.
There
we go. Okay. I got you now. You back with me?
Yeah, Chris? Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Just making sure. Okay, so you have the scenario that plays out. You have a three different, yep, let me get back here, because that call was kind of weird. You have a situation where you have a Hubble telescope that cost $1 billion, okay, or actually ended up costing more. And a lot of people were upset about that, but once we got the images back and after they actually corrected the optics issue, yeah, that was corrected early on, then we had a wonderful, wonderful craft, and now we have the James Webb telescope going up and some stuff that's in the works behind that, which is absolutely amazing. What a lot of people don't know is that the Hubble Space Telescope was based on an existing design, which was in the Keyhole series of satellites, you know, the KH-11s and that series, which we call Keenan's. and they built three of those, you know, specific to that same design. And if this is the same person, I'm going to have a problem. Okay, here we go. So, anyway, sorry about that.
It's okay,
don't you just love being live? Just being live is what.
Hey, man, anybody that's been listening to this show with you on it knows that, like, you are crack-a-lack-a, man. And like you said, we'll be getting to the every interruption is something going on about the Vegas shooting.
Literally. Pretty much, yeah. That actually was.
Yeah.
So here we have, and I'll be brief on this because we want to get to the meat of what we got going on. But when they built the Hubble, they actually built more than three, but they built two additional ones that were basically built for the National Reconnaissance Office. National Reconnaissance Office sat on this for a while because they probably thought they were going to have the exact same optics issues that the Hubble has. But part of the reason why the Hubble couldn't see straight was because the optics and the mirror grinding and all of this was new to the company that made the mirror. We're not going to name the company. So the company that made the mirror ground the optics the exact same way they did for just pretty much anything else, which is the Keenan satellites, which are designed to focus on something on the ground. So now you're trying to make something focus on something, you know, 13.72 billion light years away, which would be back to the beginning of time and the Big Bang and everywhere in between.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. So what happened was a few years ago, anyone can look this up, NASA was actually contacted by the NRO and said, hey, you remember that telescope that you guys put up? I think they called it Hubble or something like that. And NASA's like, yeah, I remember that. Okay, great. We got a couple more. Would you like one or two?
Yeah, we got
They got a couple just sitting around, and if you want. So they gifted those to NASA, and NASA has them now. They haven't really done much with them because I think with the James Webb going up or what have you, but I always thought that was an interesting story, and a lot of people aren't aware of that, but I thought it was pretty cool. So fast forward to this past week, unless you want to go into a different subject.
No, go ahead.
Okay, that was a hell of a segue, right? So here we have the largest mass shooting in United States history. The case that should be the most scrutinized case of all time when it comes to any crime of this nature. You had 58 people that died that night and an additional person that died later. And then you had Stephen Paddock who committed suicide himself that evening. So you have a total of 60 deaths. We'll just count the 59 because we're not going to count Stephen Paddock. So you have this situation go on, and the case is being investigated, and everyone that's listening to this knows that this case was odd from the beginning. It was not like any other mass shooting case. This case is unprecedented. It wrote a new chapter in every book that could ever possibly be written about this. The investigation, who we thought in the beginning was going along rather smoothly, and then all of a sudden just totally went to crap. We knew we weren't getting any information, and everything was being swept under the rug. We quickly, being the smart people that we are, determined that, hey, something is going on wrong here, and apparently someone's trying to push whatever under the rug. So that is an issue. And what happened is this. After the investigation was basically done, we had the FIT report. We had the preliminary FIT report that told us what was going on. Then we had the final FIT report that told us what was going on. And then we're all sitting, waiting with bated breath, waiting for this FBI report to come out. This is going to tell us everything. This is going to answer all of the questions. And Aaron Rouse was on NPR radio. He was on there saying, yes, well, we have the report coming out and it should, you know, it's going to be out. You know, we're delaying it to make certain that we get everything right and all this different stuff. And lo and behold, we receive this report. Now, the Sandy Hook report and, some of these other reports are in at the low end, 1,000 pages, at the high end, maybe around 2,000 pages or so.
Yeah.
So this FBI report comes out, the BAU report, and it was a while. Do you remember how long that was? Was it like two, maybe three pages?
Yeah, it was. It was not a detailed report at all.
No, and it basically was supposed to go into the motive and what have you. So yeah, we get
like
past all
report.
That. Right. And so during the, exactly. And it was like the top 10 things or top 10 reasons as to why Steve Paddock did this. It's like they purposely went with 10 because they probably had 7 or 8, but they stretched it to 10 or whatever they did. But it looked like a stupid top 10 list from,
it's the best clickbait ever.
Yes, it exactly was. So here it is. And of course, everybody gets it. Now, this whole case has been terrible in regards to how the survivors and the victims' families of this case have been treated. In no time in history has any other case affected people the way this case has.
Yeah.
Mainly, think of this. You have a case to where, first, we weren't getting information anyway. The only CCTV footage that existed outside of Mandalay Bay or MGM's control or even LVMPD's control was mine, the video that I put out.
Yeah.
And so we found ourselves going to places like YouTube and on the internet looking for information because we knew mainstream media wasn't giving us information. So lots of theories were coming out and what have you and whatnot. We're not going to go into that.
Well, and we already knew at that time that the timeline with the police had changed by like 2 or 3 times.
Right, you know? Exactly.
So they weren't obviously being forthright.
Exactly. And even myself and Laura Loomer, mm-hmm. we actually ended up changing the timeline twice just because of our reporting.
Yeah.
So when you have researchers who are not part of the, you know, we're not like mainstream media, we're not investigators, we're not FBI, but we're able to find information that they can't, that's a problem. That's a major problem.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, you're really good. But they're supposed to be like really, really, really good.
Yeah. They're supposed to be way better than we are. And they have access to the evidence. We don't have access to the evidence. We're winging it. We're going down there. We're in the trenches. We're talking to people and doing whatever. So let's fast forward a little bit further. Then information starts coming our direction. Okay. Then we hear that you know, they're going to go into these settlement talks and what have you. So they start that process, and then you know they're going to choose mediators and things of this nature. And I think you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
But then they did something unprecedented too. An unprecedented thing was done in the fact that MGM decided, you know what, this would be smart for us to do a delay tactic or to distract things or whatever, or to just basically try to wrap all this up under one federal umbrella. Let's go out and sue the victims.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. Let's do that. We're gonna sue 1,900 victims in this case so we can wrap this in a federal wrapper and basically remove ourselves from liability to the case.
Yeah.
Maybe a smart move, maybe a very terrible PR move, but basically
it was a PR move.
Oh my God, it's probably the worst. If you had to list the worst PR fiascos in history, I think that would rank right. I can think of a couple more, but right now, that's the only one I can think of. So that was bad. So now we move forward a little bit. So all of the claimants, there's around 4,400 people that actually joined on the lawsuit against MGM. Out of that, probably about 2,500 or so were basically with one attorney, and he kind of took the lead in the Las Vegas area because, you know, you have to have someone that's going to go down and actually be in front of the court and do all this other stuff. So I get that part. So at some point in time, they had to choose because they're going to settlement, and to go to the settlement, you have to have some form of mediation. To have a mediation, you have to have a mediator.
Yes.
So they decided to choose a person for the mediator. Now, what I'm about to tell you is straight across the board, absolutely true, but it's going to sound made up. They chose a mediator by the name of Jennifer Togliatti. She was actually a judge on the 8th Circuit Court, I believe, and she retired a little bit early, but maybe it was part of her actual plan to retire at that time. But she retired in her 19th year, and then she moved into mediation. Okay, great. Mm. She's a great judge, okay? I have no issue with this person at all. I've gone back and looked at her cases, and she has solved settlement cases that otherwise people couldn't get solved. If there's no resolution, go to Togliatti, she can get it done. So she's a great judge. But the issue that came out was the fact that the judge's father was the vice president of MGM Resorts International. This is the judge who is going, or a former judge who is now mediator for the settlement, who is going to manage $800 million of settlement, or basically, you know, mediate how the how it's all going to be settled and all the details on how they're going to contact people and the point system that they're going to put into play to figure out who gets what and how to divide the money. All these different things that are just really whatever. I'll say again, she's a great judge, great mediator, but and also she doesn't really, she's not really supposed to and probably doesn't have any power in her say. She can't go in there and say, well, you're going to have to do this and you're going to have to do that. No, she basically oversees what's going on.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say that she would even do something in the vested interest of MGM on purpose, but the fact that they brought somebody in who is even vaguely related.
Yeah, but wait.
There's more.
So... Oh, man. Remember Ron Popeil?
I know, Ron.
I mean, he's the greatest marketer of all time, the pocket fisherman.
Right,
I mean,
now, guy.
Yes, he started it all. You got the rotisserie. I mean, all of these things that this guy did. But wait, there's more. Now, here you go. Okay, so not only was he the vice president of MGM. So you have the judge is the mediator, and her father is the vice president of MGM. Okay, well, maybe there's not going to be any correlation. Okay, but... And he's not only is he a vice president, he's also the head of security.
Oh.
So, okay. So he's vice president. Okay, now he's the head of security. So he's the head of what they call safety, surveillance, and security.
How long has he been the head of the Triple S?
Since 2007, I believe, is the date he came on.
What the hell is a vice president of a corporation doing being the head of security?
Well, I mean, basically, you have to have your inside
structure. Your, how jank
yeah, it's
is
a
that?
Part of the corporate structure, and so you have your president, which was Jim Murren, okay, which we all know and love.
Sure,
facetiously and sarcastically, I'm saying this. So we have Jim Murren, who's the head, and then of course you have all the different departments that come up under below it, and naturally, security is one of those. Now, he wasn't just the head of security for Mandalay Bay. This guy was the head of security for MGM.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a problem there. So he's the vice president of MGM. He's also the head of, he's vice president in charge of security, safety, and surveillance. I don't remember which way the S's go.
Sure.
The only S's I can think of is what I do in the morning when I go to the bathroom. So you have him in that position. Okay. But wait a minute. This is becoming a hard pill to swallow. But Chris, wait. There's more.
There's more.
So here we have this guy. He's the father of the judge who's going to manage the settlement for the $800 million. He's the vice president of MGM, and he's the head of security. But he was also, now get this, he was the supervisory field agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation for the office, for the field office in Las Vegas.
What?
For over 20 years.
What?
Yeah. Yes. I'm telling you straight up. I know I did not warn you before this show, and I probably should have sent you some information ahead of time.
Dude. I cannot believe this.
This is think about this.
Worked
if you and
the
I
Vegas
sat down
field office. So if he ain't got Cole, who does?
Exactly. So not only is there a conflict of interest, I mean, the definition of conflict of interest has just been exploded in this whole thing. This is just beyond ridiculous. So now that's a bigger pill to swallow. Now, he was formerly by a different governor, I think Governor Quinn, if I'm pronouncing his name right. Mm. He was under Governor Quinn. He was also the head of the Department of Safety for Nevada. So now... Get this time frame. So on the night of October 1, 2017, a date that has changed my life and that of many, many others. Yeah, you know, I'm way on the low end of the totem pole here. But people's lives have been affected drastically on that date. On that evening, he was the vice president of MGM, head of security for MGM. He was also formerly a supervisory field agent for the FBI. But this man's office was actually in Mandalay Bay. That's where he worked. It wasn't like he was at some corporate office in some other city somewhere.
Yeah,
this man worked
could have been
every
Atlantic
day.
City. Could have been anywhere.
It could have been anywhere. I mean, so now we're looking at these pills that are getting harder and harder to swallow. They're the size, they're not the size of a horse pill. They're the size of the freaking horse. So we're looking at this and I'm going, okay, how can this possibly have gotten past anyone? So here's how that happened. When this this information was originally put out, you have like two or three core groups of attorneys, and I'm not going to get into any internal conflicts that may have arisen out of that or whatever, because as anyone can imagine, if you have 60 different law firms working together, then naturally you're going to have 60 different opinions of how things should be done and what have you. But they did miraculously pull this off. I mean, I got to admit, they did get this together and push it through. But there's more problems here. But wait, there's more.
Damn you, Ron.
This is so unbelievable. I mean, Chris, you and I are fairly.
You're going to make me sit here for an hour, aren't you, Ron?
No, I'm just going to wait. But at the end of this, three easy payments of $49.95.
I was supposed to be on my way to church 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, good luck with that. And I'll try to keep it under the hour time frame so everybody in Ohio can get this. Yeah, I know. I'm teasing too. If you still have the Ohio audience, I just want to make sure they get everything before we have to sign them off.
Sure.
So here we go. I'm not really dragging this out. This is just how it has to be done. So we have all of this stuff done, and I'm not laughing because I think that the event is not. It's a nervous, crazy laugh that this actually has occurred, that this really happened in real life. If you and I were sitting down trying to write, if we were writing a movie and we said, okay, all right, let's do the script. Okay, here's the storyboard. Okay, director, here's what we want to do. We're gonna have this judge whose father is going to work inside the building where the shooting actually originated from, and she's going to settle the entire settlement. And so the settlement's going to be $800 million. So it's going to be a huge amount, but not as much as it really should have been, but $800 million. And there's a story behind that, too. And so we're going to do this, and the killer, or whatever you want to call him, the shooter, actually shot from that building. Now, the guy that is the father of the judge will work in this building, and he's also the vice president of the entire company, which has multiple locations worldwide, and you know, everything else that goes along with it. No one would buy that script. They would say, this isn't, no one's going to believe this.
This is like, what consultant did you get on this? Because this is horrible.
Yeah, this is so poorly written.
Believable.
no one's gonna believe this, because this is like, you remember how I don't know about you growing up, but every now and then I'd walk in and my mom's watching Young and the Restless or Guiding Light or something, and I'd sit down for a few minutes and watch it.
Whatever.
Yeah, this sounds like one of the scripts that would be on one of those shows. And so because it's just so ludicrous, it's so absurd, no one would believe it, but it'll work for a daytime, you know, I don't even know what they call those shows. My brain's so far gone.
Like the judge was pregnant with Eric's baby. You know, that's the cliffhanger for the season.
So all these, and so it just becomes unreal. Now, so here's kind of my summation of what happened. As everyone knows, I worked with Catherine Lombardo early on in this investigation.
Yeah,
and may she rest in peace. You know, she died a few days after my mother did last year, and it was a very devastating time for me. And to lose her was very devastating, because we were in the middle of quite a few things, and it just kind of like I had to go dark. I went off the map. You remember, you didn't see me for a while, and no one did. And I just said, man, this is just too much. So here we are again, and now we have a lot of survivors out there who are just now, they're not just now getting this information. This information was given out to the survivors. Now, each attorney group sent this information in a different format out to their own claimants, their own clients, claimants, same word. So you have this, and the problem is that the information was disseminated differently amongst the group. So that might be an issue, may not be an issue. Now I will say this. This could be a lot about nothing. Okay? Let's play devil's advocate for a minute.
Sure.
Okay. Let's just say the judge is, you know, this is not like somebody has to
draw. Willing to give the benefit of the doubt.
Of course. You're a very intelligent, very wise man, knowledgeable, and very rational, fair.
Doesn't stink like hell. But
right.
It doesn't mean that anything nefarious is actively going on. There's
exactly.
Just something that's like, what the Shasta is this?
Exactly. So what I don't want to do is create this huge hysteria or of a lot of people going, what? I just heard from, you know, 5x5 News and Chris Jordan at Dudes and Beer. And the guy, and the boys would be like, 5x5 News,
Chris Jordan
and
his disinformation agent.
Yeah, exactly. Where's my check? Did you get yours? Hey, I keep.
Hey, man, I haven't gotten it. It is in the mail, I promise.
Thank you, baby. Here we have all of this going on, and here it is. Last week was the last. You have a series of deadlines of when you can actually file for the. You know, you have your opt in and opt out forms, and you know this is just normal stuff. I'm not releasing anything that's like proprietary. Attorney client privileged information. This is shit that we just. I'm sorry. This is just stuff that we know goes on in a case like this. And so as you get to a certain point, you look at it and you go, so we have these dates, and now this information is coming back up again. Now, what I will say, I was contacted by a survivor, a claimant, and I can name his name because he is no longer a part of the case. His name is Roger Keenis. Okay. Roger contacted me and said, hey, you know, because I've known Roger for a while, and actually the way we met was one of his videos, and me and him had huge arguments about it and whatever, but the guy's just a great guy. He's a Marine, okay? And so he contacts me, and he says, hey, you need to look at this. And I looked at it, and I don't know how I missed this, but back in October 3rd of last year, Doug Papa, who's a good friend of mine, Doug Papa put out a story. And in his story, he actually leaked this information. Now, why it didn't take off like wildfire back then, I don't know. It was at the bottom of one of his stories, and it said, author notes, author has been contacted by many people who have questioned whether or not there's an issue with the relationship between Judge Togliatti and her father, who's a corporate vice president at MGM. Okay, so I didn't see that, and apparently a lot of people didn't. But I have to I'll say it right now. Doug Papa gets credit for bringing this out first. Roger Keenis gets credit for, you know, bringing this back out and making it, you know, stick. And here I am. I'm coming out. I guess making certain that as many people as possible either know about it. But at the same time, I don't have enough information to say that some nefarious activity had happened. I can't sit here and say, guess what? There's more. And I found the smoking gun where the father told the daughter to cap the amount or to make the other attorneys listen to this. So we don't have that. So I just want to be real
to
clear.
To redistribute funds or to cease funds going anywhere.
Right,
nothing
right.
like that. Like we said, there's no evidence of anything nefarious. Nothing like that. I'm not even going to say yet. Because I'm
right.
like you,
yeah.
I'm an optimist. I have my faith in humanity still.
Yeah, I do too.
But it's one of those that's like, dude, that's just how that's like somebody just shooting flares in the air. That's not even a red flag,
right? But even at the surface level, you know, the problem is the attorneys back in the beginning and the claimants and anyone that is very aware of this and are okay with it. They have to remember that back when they first heard it, they were like, what?
Now,
so let me get this. Now, imagine being a fly on the wall inside. You have all these attorneys. Let's just pretend all these attorneys are sitting around on this round table meeting, and you're a fly on the wall, and you're just sitting there, and the attorneys are talking, and they say, okay, on to matter number blah, blah, blah. In the settlement case, da 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 da. Here we have, we're choosing two mediators for this case because we have a slight problem of a possible conflict of interest with the first one. So we chose another mediator who happens to be in California because the majority of the claimants are in California. So we probably should have some form of representation there because there may be some obscure laws we're not familiar with, you know, whatever the reason.
Sure. And it may very well be the case that this judge that they brought in is the only sitting circuit judge in the area that has experience with such a case. There could be a myriad of reasons why they're brought in. And not only that, hey, man, I'm Cajun. I've literally run into people that I've known my whole life. And once we both get in front of somebody that we didn't know we mutually knew, it's like, holy crap, you're my cousin.
That sounds like North Florida stuff there.
I literally hung out with a dude at my college for like 6 months. We were like tight, like best friends, man.
Yeah.
And then I went to Thanksgiving and started talking to somebody and they were like, wait a minute, Russell Byrd. Is his mom this? I was like, yeah. And they started talking, man, that's your third, that's like your fourth cousin. I was like, what the hell are you talking about?
And I went, you say Russell Byrd?
Byrd. B-Y-R-D.
Okay, good.
But yeah, we started talking whenever I got back, and he was like, no way. And we started tracing things and talking family members. I was like, holy crap, dude, I cannot believe that. Like, dang, Cajun families.
Yeah, it's crazy. I did not know that my second wife was my third cousin until the fourth year.
There you go.
Exactly. Okay, now that's going to come out. Somebody's going to say something. Well, you married your cousin.
That's the kind of relation that could happen that we're talking about, where this is discovered down the line, and hey, they may never even know that they're related. They may not be going to the same family reunion. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But I do believe this judge knows that her daddy was the vice president.
That's a little bit tough. I mean, I'm just devil's advocating. But
I know, I'm reeling you back in with my pocket fisherman. Mm-hmm. So we have this going on. Okay, so now they, you know, keep in mind in the beginning of this investigation. Let me know if you got to go to break or anything. At the beginning of this investigation, a couple of things were a problem, and the problem was not enough information was going out. And again, I alluded to it earlier that created an error that was rife for conspiracy theories, this and whatever. And you and I have different beliefs on several different things that happened. Sure. But hey, we're good buddies and we get past that. But this is like a real conspiracy. Okay, yes. And that this, you know, and a conspiracy doesn't necessarily mean that something actually happened. It just, you know, from the appearance of it, you know, there may be something there. So a lot of people think there's smoke, there's fire or whatever, but we haven't really seen the smoke yet. So there's really not an issue to look for a fire, but it does look like a duck. And so, you know, we need to look at this a little deeper. And if there's something there, there's something there. But here's what's going to make this a problem. This is what's going to turn this into a PR issue. And if you're working for MGM, or if you're one of the attorneys in this case, or if you're one of the claimants listening to my voice right now, here's the thoughts that are going to come out that everyone's going to play up. And I'm going to try to, and you know, as always, I will try to give you the most accurate information as possible, mm-hmm. without anything that's going to make you think that there's some other, you know, something else is going on. So here's the deal. The problem is this. You have a judge, again, who stepped down from her job, not necessarily a year early. It was, you know, it was apparently her planned retirement. But then she took a job as a mediator with a company called ARM, okay? And that's in Nevada. I was just there. And so this company, ARM, does nothing but mediations, okay? So if she's working there, then they probably have their own code of ethics, an internal code of ethics that they have to go by, because on a judge level, lawyer level, bar level, whatever, there's three different various ways to handle codes of ethics. You've got your AAA code of ethics, you've got your American Bar Association, your ABA ethics, you got all these different ethics, but they don't apply to this case. So immediately when I broke this story, or actually, again, I want to give credit where credit is due. Doug Papa broke this story, but when I guess you could say I rebroke this story. When I rebroke this story and it started getting some traction, a lot of people started taking off and looking for codes of ethics and laws that were broken and things of that nature. Well, stop looking, because this was a private mediation, and in private mediation, you're not bound by the same rules and laws. So I just want to make sure everybody, you know, I don't want people sitting there going, wow, this has got to be wrong, and find something. And then tomorrow I get like 1,000 emails saying, well, did you see this? Did you see this? And I get that all the time.
Yeah. So yes, are different during mediation than when they are once you hit a courtroom, things like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Rules of discovery. And in a civil case, the rules of discovery don't really apply as well, because it's not a criminal case. It's civil. And this case was already settled. So since this case was settled, then all they're doing now is the mediation process. Now, in the mediation process, obviously, she was part of that to get the amount. The issue I have myself is this, and the issue that people will see, because you cannot not see this. I love saying that. You cannot not see this. Yeah. What you're seeing is a dollar amount that was stalled. Now, I could actually read this to you, but I've seen it so many times that I can probably almost verbatim say it, but I'm just going to say it from the top of my head roughly what was said. Right early on in the mediation, a particular attorney, his name is Robert T. Eglett, okay? Robert Eglett has around 2,500 or so of the claimants, somewhere between 2,400, 2,500, whatever it is. It's a majority of the claimants.
Yeah.
And he's also in Vegas. He has this beautiful law office and all these other different things. And he's a great attorney as far as looking at his resume. The problem I have is that, and this is terrible. I think, remember when we did the thing on the money machine, I think we went this route.
Oh, but you mean when you guest bombed my show?
Yes, I forgot about that. I did do that.
Great. That was epic, that though, was, man.
That was a beautiful show. So anyone listening to this, if you have not seen the Dudes and Beer episode where Ramsey Dennison is the director of the documentary, you need to go back and watch that, too.
Yeah.
You need to watch everything that Chris Jordan does, because he's an amazing guy, and he does amazing work, and he gets the guests that just have... And it's fun. You know, doing your show is fun because it's not super structured, and I don't feel like somebody's going to pin me down a certain thing, and I love it, and I love you for that.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome, dude. If you say, hey, Mike, can you come in here and talk to me about popping popcorn, I would be on your show explaining that Jiffy Pop used to be the way to go, but no longer.
And there have been a couple interviews where I've read, and it's been like, really? You put two sentences from Mike Turber in your thing?
Yeah.
Like you mentioned Mike Turber, and then you said two sentences from him like that. Like, you could not have chopped that further. I know him. I talk with him regularly, like even in texts, and it goes further than two sentences.
I know what story you're talking about. That's a Tic Tac story right there. I know exactly.
And it was like, what the hell?
I'm the last few sentences.
You didn't even ask him the questions. What the hell?
I know. The last two sentences in the whole thing, I'm like, hey, man, that world's about to get rocked here pretty soon, too. So you got a whole other show on that one.
So, yeah. Anyway.
All right. So cycling back, because a lot of people are saying, hey, Mike, get to the meat. And so I already gave you the meat, but here's the meat. You got the bread and the butter and side salad. And this thing just is a four-course meal. So everybody just sit back, relax, and you be prepared. As the case is being settled, you have Robert T. Eglett. He comes out and he says someone leaked the amount of $800 million. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So Robert Eglett comes out and says, oh, no, that amount is nowhere near where we're going to be. That's nothing. You divide that amount. You take $800 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but you divide that by 4,400 claimants. It's not so much anymore, especially with what these people went through. So a lot of people who first heard the $800 million, in their mind, they didn't calculate out what this really means. But that amount stuck. Now, I'm not a speaker for the survivors. There's another person that we've elected to be the speaker of whatever. I don't know what he does. But anyway, so I'm not speaking for the survivors. I'm speaking for what any logical, rational person would look at this and go, $800 million. divided by 4,500 comes out to 100 and some odd thousand. Take out the 33 to 40% that the Warriors get, and you're going to walk away with not nearly what you probably thought. So yeah. that's the problem. The problem I have with Eglin, now, you know, no offense to any, I just want to make it clear, I don't have a problem with hardly any other attorney in this entire case except him. And the reason why is because he basically spoon-fed that out, not only to the claimants, but from what I saw from working, you know, inside, not like working like I got paid, I wish, but from looking at the, when I bring evidence to Catherine or I bring some information or somebody would say something, I'd say, here, and Catherine was pretty much my go-to girl, you know, and there was other, go-to girl, that sounded bad, but, you know, she was the person I would bring this stuff to, and it was just easy because she was literally 7 miles away from me.
Yeah.
Okay, and I could go in there and show it to her. If I had glass from Paddock's room, I'd put it on the table, she could see it. You know, the video for Melissa Ramirez, that was there, and that was the hardest decision I think I've ever made in my life. Mm. But when it comes down to sleazy, slimy, grimy, just ridiculous turnarounds, this guy, Robert Eglin, I don't even like saying his name, and I hate talking about somebody like this because it's just not my style. If he took the words, he said that in his 30 plus or 30 or so years of being a lawyer, of practicing law, he had never seen such a reprehensible company as MGM. He had not seen anyone do the underhanded things that MGM had done, right? The day he announced the settlement, I think it was October 2nd or October 3rd, so 2 days or a day or two after the statute of limitations was covered,
yeah.
He comes out and says, after he does a 40-minute conference, and I have a copy of that conference on my channel, so 5x5 News on YouTube, and you can see the entire conference or the entire, I call it the ask-kiss-a-thon that this Robert Eglin put on. So a few minutes into his press conference, he says, we've achieved settlement. We've landed on $800 million. And everybody's like, wait, it's still $800 million? You didn't go up? What kind of attorney stops? The very first time it was leaked out was $800 million. So we put that aside. Then as he moves forward, then he says, I just want to say that in my X number of years of practicing law, I have not worked with and had an opponent that was such a great opponent as MGM, and they're a model company. And I'm like, well, this is the same guy.
Yeah.
Just
a few months. Kissing your opponent's butt right
now. Yeah. Like, so my bells and whistles go off in my head. I'm wondering, who is this guy to say, like a few months ago, you know, we were like, I would quote him like going, yeah, you go, Eglin, you're awesome. And yeah, this company's reprehensible and they do this and they're slime and all these different, you know, adjectives that he could throw around. And then all of a sudden, this is a model corporation for the state of Nevada. I would have my family stay there. Well, I'm sure you probably would have your family stay there. They're probably comp for the rest of their lives.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly.
You know, but something happened. And in my mind's thinking, what in the hell could have possibly happened to cause an attorney to flip like that? To go
to friend.
Yes. So you go from that, I mean, and of course, everybody listening to this is going, okay, wait a minute, we got to go back and change all these sound bites or whatever. And here I am in the middle of filming a documentary with Ramsey, and I'm thinking, wow, we got all these sound bites, and now he's saying this? Well, who are you working for? Are you working for the claimants? Are you working for MGM? Did something happen? And that's all speculation. You know, I don't want to get a defamation case on your show.
No, absolutely not. I don't want one either.
No, you wouldn't get one. It would be me. So at the end of it, you'll hear me say, Michael Trump is not a representative. Yeah, so they used to, I want to learn how to do that.
Yeah.
Or just record one, and every time I talk to somebody, especially if I meet a girl for the first time, I'll put that disclaimer out there, and it'll be really fast. You won't know what happened. So we move forward again. So now I'm perplexed. Now I'm really confused. I'm thinking, and if I'm confused, the survivors and the claimants and the families of the victims in this case have got to be mind-boggling confused. Okay, just what, or may have already checked out and said, you know, you handle it for me. They don't want to deal with the stress. That's cool too. Whichever the decision is, and I don't want to bring any stress to the survivors or to anyone in this case. thinking that this case is going to derail and they're going to go back and they have to do all this other stuff. That's the odds of that happening are so extremely remote. It's ridiculous. And I have a duty. You just like you have a duty. If something comes to you that even though it may rub people wrong, or even though it may not that it won't be true, but if you kind of have like a duty as a member of the press, as the media, as you are and as I am,
do at the least explore.
Yeah, at least explore. And then if you find something that's concrete, because everything I've told you tonight is 100% concrete. She is the daughter of the vice president. No one has to look this up. I mean, but please do. Please do. Go look it up. But this woman's the daughter. And it's a conflict of interest on face value. This is, in my mind, what should have happened. This is my opinion. Everything I've told you before is partially 100% or 93.6% fact, I think, is how I used to say it. So you have all this. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm a little distracted because I'm sitting there just mind-boggling.
It works every time.
Right. So you have this judge who probably should have walked out when she was getting herself vetted in this process. If I was her, okay, I'm not saying that this should have happened, but if I was her,
she
I would have came out.
Herself.
Exactly. 100%. And I don't look good in the judge's garb anyway. But so if you come out and you know this is an issue, if you should just recuse yourself.
Yeah.
No, that didn't happen. Not only did that not happen. You know, and just so people know, the term recusal is a judge who finds out that they cannot work a case for whatever the reason is. It could be a personal reason, could be a health reason. It doesn't matter what the reason is. The judge would come out and say, I have to recuse myself from this case because my dad is the vice president of MGM. Hey, and that would be a clear conflict of interest.
Even in a criminal case, I wish that we had J.L. Carpenter on right now, but even in a criminal,
bring her back.
Even in a criminal case,
listening.
My friend, if you are like doing a jury selection, one of the things you have to ask is, does anybody here know?
Yes.
This
correct.
Person, the judge involved with the case.
Right.
Anything.
Right.
And if so, they cannot serve on the jury.
Right.
You can't
right.
even serve on the jury, so how could you possibly be the judge of remediation?
Is this not the most mind-boggling? I mean, of all of the things, and you and I have been through this case since day one. We've seen things we haven't even reported.
I was thinking Shannon Ray Caffey, actually. He's on. He says hi. On our watch
love
party,
you,
but I was just telling him online, like, thank you so much for introducing me to Mike and Ram.
Yes.
It really just changed a lot of what we cover and how we cover things on this show. And,
yep.
You know, having you guys investigate this and being there literally since months after it happened.
Right.
Since the timeline really started getting figured out.
Exactly, and this is disturbing news. And Shannon is the first person I met. Not the first person I met like talking to, but to physically when I was physically there, it was me, Laura Loomer. We're walking around and we see Shannon and his wife, and they're walking around the grounds because the tape had just come down. So we're the first people in the grounds. Okay, not where the vendors were, but the parking area and everything like this. And so Shannon was the first person I met, and out of everyone I've ever met in my entire life, if I had to pick five people that were just the most honest, sincere, wonderful people in the world that I've met, Shannon is there. And in fact, I can't even think of another person at this moment other than maybe it's Chris Jordan.
Oh,
but
you're sweet.
But Shannon is definitely on that list. And for me to sit there and watch the things he's gone through. I'm a reporter and I have to do, I'm not really even a reporter. I'm just a guy. I'm really just a guy that has some skills and I decided to do something with my skills and I call myself a reporter. I didn't go to reporter school if there's such a thing. I've never been to a school with journalism. I don't have some certificate on my wall saying I can do this or that.
Start the U.S. press corps, but you know, whatever. Whatever.
Yeah. It's a secret. It's between me and
badges.
Trump and you were on that call.
Yeah.
so we have all this, and then to see him And when this first came out, I did not even want to really involve it. His last week or two has been very stressful. So I don't even want to bring that up. And I wasn't going to about to add this to it, but now in the last week, this information has made its way and you're probably the first, you're going to get this before NBC does. This information is now going to be probably national news tomorrow night, starting at, say, 10 o'clock.
There's something horrible, going on.
I can tell you this. I contacted certain media outlets, and I won't name them, but there's certain media outlets inside the city of Las Vegas whose names rhyme with Day Gay or something like that. But there's two letters, R, I think some other letters. And I contacted them directly, gave them this information, and they probably already knew it. I don't know. I contacted a certain anchor person that I know at one of the local stations there. Uh-huh. I think people can figure out who that is. I contacted a few other people. Now, this is kind of like after the fact. But one of the claimants, I won't mention her name, but she'll be on the NBC News story. So I'm going to shield her identity. She contacted a local reporter where she lives, near where she lives. And this reporter contacted me within minutes of hearing this, because they needed some sort of, and I'm not an official in this case. I mean, as much as I would love to say I'm not, but to confirm, because the story was so outlandish. The story is so absurd that no one could possibly take it at face value of someone who, and go, oh yeah, yeah, okay, if I was a reporter and someone called me up and say, hey, I got some inside information on Las Vegas case, I know it's 2.5 years into it, but here you go. This reporter would be like, there's no way, we're 2.5 years into this. Someone would have spilled the beans. Someone would have said something. Well, someone did say something. You know, Roger Keenis said something.
Yeah.
He spoke extremely well. Roger Keenis is who contacted, Doug Papa. And Doug Papa wrote a story. And at the end of the story, he mentioned this information. So this information got out there, but for some reason or another, it didn't take traction. That's kind of fine, but kind of not, because either someone was suppressing this for whatever reason, and that's, If they have a valid reason for it, let me know what that is, because I can't think of one. This at surface level, even if, and I'll reiterate this, and I don't want to belabor the point, but Judge Togliatti's a great judge. I cannot see fault in her. George, her father, George Togliatti, I have a problem with him, and I can tell you why in a minute. But I don't have a problem with him being like the vice president of MGM. I don't really even have that big of a problem with him being related to the judge, because there may not be anything, just like you alluded to earlier, there may not be anything nefarious going on at all.
Yep.
But wouldn't you think for just a second that, hey, this just on the surface level really is a hard pill to make everybody swallow. Let's table Jennifer Togliatti for a moment. And if we absolutely cannot find within a reasonable amount of time another mediator who has the skills that she has, then we'll bring her back and then we'll talk. But they didn't do that. Uh-uh. This was the first batch. Now, the reason why I was told this, I was told that they had worked with her before. I'm like, okay. Well, that in and of itself kind of sounds like there's a conflict. You've worked with this mediator who was formerly a judge. You've worked with her before. When is there a before? She just left the bench. She just started working for ARM. If this is her first case, how could you possibly have worked with her before? There's a problem there. So my mind starts thinking. So I go back and I look at her cases, and then I start seeing, okay, well, she did a case, and she's helped a case settle for MGM before, blah, blah, blah. And maybe because they know her and they know how good she is and she's a wonderful person, blah, 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 this may be all over nothing. But still, this on the surface of it is just not good for business. It just does not look right.
Well,
now, George, talk to me.
Yeah, like we were saying, there may not be anything inappropriate going on, but
right.
definitely it's one of those that's a really close association to not recuse yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, it could be the fact that she hates her father.
It could be. You're not going to find her. Yeah, you won't.
You know, like maybe the nefarious thing is that she's going to take MGM for more money. This is nowhere near what they deserve.
Well, if he had any influence on that, she did a terrible job because that $800 million. Job. Oh,
yeah.
There's more. Sorry, I forgot the other one. The other way, there's more. We could do a 5-hour show, but we're gonna compress this down. We're gonna get all the Ohio people in on the end before this 59-minute mark.
So if you like the pocket fisherman, you're gonna love the Floby.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Check this out. But wait, there's more. We got the Floby, we got the pocket fisherman, and we're gonna give Chris a chicken rotisserie.
A free rotisserie oven.
Yeah. And I hated that. I couldn't get it to work for a flip, man. That thing was fun. But
anyway.
Yeah, they were. Okay, so here we go. So now we have this $800 million settlement. On the $800 million settlement, the judge gets the information and the settlement stalls at $800 million. Everyone in this case knows that the settlement stalled at $800 million, right?
Yeah.
So now we go back in time. Let's go back and start figuring out why it settled at $800 million. Do you know why, Chris?
Why is that?
Here's why. This is like me and you just having a conversation.
Is that just like right underneath what you have to report for taxes?
Close. If you sued a company,
$800 million in one, gotta turn them in.
Exactly. So at $800 million, here's what you have: you have an insurance policy that's going to pay $750 million of that amount.
So you are only liable for $50 million.
$50 million, and there's even an extenuating circumstance with the $50 million. I'm not going to get into that right now because it's complicated.
That's a hard
and hard
month.
To explain.
You know, like that's like a month of income,
right? Well, for them at $14.4 million per day on the take,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's nothing. Yeah. So they're taking $14.4 million a day. Okay, so you have this, and you've got okay. You're moving forward. The insurance company is going to, in the beginning, they said the settlement amount will be between $735 and $800 million. I love doing this because I don't have notes or anything in front of me. I'm just literally sitting here winging it. I'm swinging my arms in the air and everybody's looking. So we got $735 million to $800 million is the settlement. In that range is $750, which is the cap amount. For the insurance from Zurich. Zurich is the insurance company that covers MGM properties and blah, 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 for all kinds of stuff, whether it be from slip and fall to this and whatever, which kind of gives us the reason why they wanted to try to push this off to the Safety Act. Whole nother story. So now they're only on the cuff for 50 some odd million dollars, and that's it. So there's your reason why the logic would dictate. I'm not going to say that is the reason. I don't want to say that and interject that like
but
that.
But it's not rocket math.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to be anyone looking at this with it. Yeah, it's not rocket science, not rocket math. It's not even fuzzy math. It could be common core math. I don't know. I don't know how to do common core. So it could be that math because this is so absurd that it would have to be someone's going to have to use an abacus or something to figure this out because a calculator is just not going to work. So you go back and you go, okay, $750 million, boom, boom, on the cover of that. And it stalls at that amount. And then he announces it on October 3rd that the amount is $800 million. And we're like, who does this benefit?
Yeah.
What entities are benefited by the $800 million staying the same? Okay. A lot of people don't understand that the $800 million sounds like a lot of money until you subtract $750 from it and you got $50 million and you're going to try to divide that over 4,500 people. No, that's not the case here. But that's what we're looking at. We're looking at a situation where MGM is only responsible for $50 or so million. That's like a slap on the wrist. But it is what it is. What I have to say is all the attorneys agreed to this. 95%+ of, I guess, the claimants had to agree to it, because that was the cap that they had to get to make certain that this would go through. If I remember correctly, I don't know if that's the correct number, but I believe it was 95% of the people had to agree to this, or the lawyers had to agree to it, to get this amount to go through. So everyone agreed to it. So I'm not saying that the survivors and the claimants and the victims' yeah. families were out there, you know, yelling since day one that the amount is wrong. I'm just saying that if you take this whole thing and wrap it up into a package and look at it at the whole, not, and you start pulling these slices out and you start looking at it piece by piece, it's not a pretty puzzle. It's just really yeah. not. There's more.
It's definitely more than a convoluted puzzle. Yep. I think intentionally to be a convoluted puzzle. Mm-hmm. Despite any motives Stephen Paddock may have had,
right?
Despite any issues that he may have had, the right. aftermath of this, I believe, was convoluted in order to attain the ends that we're looking at now. Yeah. Where, like you're saying, things are capped out. Things are to a point where, hey, they may lose an insurance policy and have to pay more money for another insurance company, or even pay more for their rider now, but it's going to be covered by insurance, and they're only going to have to come, like, you know, like a week or two of cash cow out of pocket to take care of things, yeah. as opposed to what it could have been.
Exactly.
Which was, like we were saying earlier, really the nefarious mastermind move, the real chess move, seeing 10 moves down the line of suing the survivors to make sure that they couldn't say that MGM was responsible for their injuries.
And MGM has never accepted liability or responsibility for this. Nope. And that's normally that's typical. That's a normal part of a settlement. It's like, we'll pay you the money, but we're never going to agree or say that we were responsible for it or negligent.
That's right.
We're not going to say that our security was bad or whatever, but I'm going to say your security was bad. Here's what I'm going to say to George Togliatti, who's actually going to listen to this. Hey, George, how are you doing? I'm Mike Turber from 5x5 News. You'll probably remember this. Back in the early throes of the investigation, actually even before the shooting, sir, you had a person who tweeted out the following information, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm just going to wing it here. This person tweeted that the security at Mandalay Bay was so good that they actually have what would be considered an internal SWAT team. Their internal SWAT team is called the Emergency Response Team, or a member of it would be called an Emergency Response Team Officer. Okay, so this team of Emergency Response Team Officers would actually be activated in a situation like, I don't know, this. Okay, so here's the problem I have.
Shooting.
This mass shooting. This tweet was put out September of 2017. The shooting occurred on October 1st of 2017, within 1 month.
Yeah.
So this person was bragging about this internal SWAT team that Mandalay Bay, specific to Mandalay Bay, and MGM, had put together to handle situations. Keep in mind that you've been to Vegas many times.
Oh, yeah.
You know the geographics, you know the logistics of maneuvering things around in that little area, and how MGM properties are all fairly close together. There's a couple that are spread out, but for the most part, if you had a centralized SWAT team that was supposed to be mobilized when a situation like this happens, then where were they? Where were they? There's a lot of people listening to this have never heard of what I just said.
Yeah.
Never heard of it. But this emergency response team was supposed to be activated in a moment's notice, and when this situation happened. Now, was it actually put into play? Is it something we didn't see? Were these the guys in the black suits that were running around? No, that's not what they explained to us. And here's my problem with you, Mr. George Togliatti. You were specifically asked that question, and you specifically decided to not answer it. And I can say that. And that is a problem. So I have a problem with him on that. So that's an issue. But when you take all of this and you put it together and you start thinking back and your mind's boggling. Now here's the timeline problem. Now this is where it even gets more stupid. And I'm sorry for belaboring this too
it's
long.
More but, stupid?
Yes, but wait, there's more. But wait, there's more. There's just a couple more tidbits here, and I'll give you back your show.
No, that's all right. Go.
Okay. So here you have Judge Togliatti, and you have her stepping down in her 19th year to go into retirement, or then to move over into mediation and become a mediator, which actually pays a lot more money. So I get it. I would do it. And she's a great judge. So she would probably make a ridiculous amount more money because she would be like the prize of ARM. And I'll admit that there was one of the cases that she settled that they literally said the case could not be settled. And then she came in and settled it. An unsettleable, if that's a word, case could be settled by her. So touche, that, you know, more power to you. That's great. But here's what the more is. George Togliatti left MGM and went to work for Steve Sisolak, which we all know and love, sarcastically. So Steve Sisolak leaves and becomes governor. He was the commissioner of Las Vegas. He becomes governor of Nevada. Jim Murren, who is the president of MGM, the actual president of MGM, leaves MGM and goes to work for Steve Sisolak as the guy who's going to restart Nevada due to coronavirus. Okay, that's great. And he'll probably do a wonderful job, but he left at a mysterious time. This is just a few couple months ago. And then on top of that, you have George Togliatti, who also left. I think he left in 2019, maybe 2019. I can't remember the exact date. So George Togliatti, the guy who could not actually put together the adequate security at Mandalay Bay to protect everybody, actually is now the director of public safety. He's the head of public safety, security, and everything for the entire state of Nevada. This guy couldn't protect anyone at MGM properties. He couldn't protect the people at Mandalay Bay and across the street at another MGM property, which Las Vegas Village is an MGM property. A lot of people died that night. You had 58 that died that night, one that died later. Then you had, we don't count Steve. And then you have over 800 injured, over 400 directly shot by Stephen Paddock. So you have all of this going on. And this guy who has this on his resume. Now, his resume would look great until you got to the last thing that happened. You know, he's a supervisory field agent, 20 some odd years. He was originally the director of public safety for Nevada. Then he goes back to work for MGM Properties and works in Mandalay Bay every day. And then he leaves there, and he's pulled in by Steve Sisolak into the government. What's going on here? A lot of MGM people are now working for Steve Sisolak. Huh. That's mysterious. You know, Chris, we couldn't make this up, buddy. You and I could not sit down and write a screenplay that would have everything that we've talked about tonight. Well, this is sad.
My audience knows me. My former co-hosts know me. My wife knows me. You know me.
Yep.
I can drink. And other recreational things. And it sounds like somebody who drinks and does a lot of recreational things wrote this plot line.
Yep. And I don't really do either. I mean, I'll drink a beer every now and then. But
how far-fetched it would be. That's how crazy far-fetched it would be. Is like some crazy drunk dude in a hotel locked away during COVID by himself is writing this with the invisible bartender. Like, that's how crazy this is, dude.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. It's so absurd that you would tell the person, "I'm sorry, I took the script up to the powers that be." They looked at it and they started laughing. They said, "This is impossible. No one's going to believe this. You have to come back when it's more believable." Okay, we are at probably 60% of everything I could tell you right now as to how unbelievable this is, because there's a whole lot of other things that have happened. But this is pretty much, we'll just say 80%. Okay, the 80-20 rule of marketing.
You know, man, we've had in the time that we've been covering this together and that I've had you on and been talking with Ram and things like that.
Right.
And just been following the story and looking into things myself. We've had so many twists, so many turns. But like you said in your text, like, what I'm going to tell you tonight is bombshell. Like, this is crazy. Like, this is up where you were with saying that the body was moved because of the way that the blood was out on the shirt.
Right.
To find out through forensics. Yeah, absolutely.
And, I was vindicated a year later. Everybody said, you're crazy.
Took a year. Well, I mean, you know, you're lucky as an agent of disinformation that you were even vindicated. I say that, folks, it may sound horrible, but for those in this community, you know that whenever you're branded as an agent of disinformation, it's kind of like a badge of honor.
Exactly. And there's even internet shows that have been done about me saying, is Turber a disinfo agent?
I know.
This man who used to work for the government, this man who was a part of the clandestine community, of the intelligence community.
But Luis Elizondo is like totally on the up Lewis. And up.
Oh, yeah. I literally drove by him the day before yesterday, and I was thinking, poor Lou. He's only like 4 miles away from me.
You know,
and I was thinking to go there. And I was like, you know, just knock on his door and say, hey, Lou, I'm Mike Turber. Hey, can we have a beer and just talk for a minute? He'd probably punch me. You know, the guy's a decent sized dude.
Well, you know, Mike, I was thinking earlier today, actually, while I was cooking lunch and just kind of mentally preparing for this show and going over my mental notes and stuff. There has yet to be anybody that has released a full-on timeline of that.
Right.
In that whole disclosure situation from where it was to where we are now. And I really think that we should do that because there were quite a few people in quite a few communities on Facebook.
Yep.
That whenever I bring up the things that we talk about, like they're very unaware of them. They of course have the decision bias in their brain, in their head as to what things are. This is what they are.
Mm-hmm.
Confirmation bias. And that's pretty normal, but really it's one of those, like, I think people need to see this timeline. They need to see where he popped into the picture. They need to see where the data was, when he popped into the picture, and why things came out the way they did.
Right. Well, since the story is not officially over, you know, because the settlement has gone, but the statute of limitations is August 14th, just so everybody knows. It's a secret date that no one's supposed to know about. Sorry. Now everybody knows about it.
Yeah.
So August 14th is essentially your last day. And what that is for people who didn't opt into the settlement agreement, they have until August 14th to do their own case. They can't get in on the settlement, but they have the opportunity to do their own case because if they hear me, and they're like, this is messed up. Well, now I want to do something. Well, yeah, you have until August 14th to do it. Your chances of winning are going to be really, really low. But the problem is because they're going to look at you and say, hey, the case has already been tried. So I wouldn't recommend doing it. But at the same time, it's your decision. I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV. I used to play doctor, but I didn't play a doctor on TV. But the long story is this. There is a timeline that's being put together. There are some secret researchers. There are some people that have done an incredible amount of work on this case. I can't name them. I wish I could. But they know who they are. They're listening right now. And they're sitting there. And I want to tell them, you guys did tremendous work. Because they have brought me information that I overlooked, didn't see, and went like, wow. And they led me down certain paths. A couple of them were rabbit holes, I'll admit. I probably sent you down a couple. But for the most part,
is spent in the rabbit hole, bro.
we'll put some ice down there and shoot some beers down. And there's a certain rabbit that I won't even name his name. Cause the guy, well, I'll call him, his name's Thumper. He's been a rabbit hole in my side, or whereas this, he's not a rabbit hole. He's another type of hole. But anyway, so we have this group of people, this core group of people. It's about four or five people. And then we have some outside. We have a guy that does October 1 Sounds. That's his name on YouTube. He does a great job. We have another guy named Eric Peters. He has a YouTube channel. He does a tremendous job. So you have Eric Peters. You got October 1 Sounds. You've got Mr. Burgundy. You've got UFO hunter, all of these different guys that are out there that have done incredible work. You've got Doug Papa, who's been there like I have pretty much since day one. And we both, you know, did some, you know, we both were with Catherine Lombardo a good bit. There's a lot of unsung heroes that are out there that are, that they're working the trenches, so to speak. And these are the unsung heroes that should be looked at. Then you have the survivors, the people that actually went through all of this, and they're there just, you know, they need information. That you need closure for this, and the only way you're going to get closure is by getting the truth. And so you have that. Yep. Then you have people like Ram Dennison, who has already made a previous documentary about
he
the
don't
corruption.
Care who you and, are, he's getting you on camera, bro.
He is. And so Ram has now turned into be probably one of my best friends I've ever had, and he's just an awesome guy. And watching what he went through to make his first documentary, and you know, I wasn't there, but I feel like I've lived through it because we've talked about it so much. And me and this is going to sound weird, but me and him spending nights in a hotel together before we go to sleep, and we're just rambling stories back and forth to each other about all the kinds of crazy. And of course, my stories are crazy, and Ramsey's like, God, this guy's got to be so full of crap. But then they all check out, and he's like, holy crap. And to go through this, so you have the movie The Money Machine that's going to be coming out, and COVID, you know, has obviously affected that. But that's going to be a documentary that's going to be for the people who've gone through this. It had to shift focus a little bit because we felt that a lot of the story had to be told that wasn't being told at all, which is what was going on. You know, what were these corporations doing? Was the LVMPD actually investigating this? You know, what's going on that level? So I can't tell you how impressed I am with Ram as far as his editing skills, his directorship and stuff like this, and the ability to piece it together a story that otherwise would be disjointed, not told in such a way. But he is amazing. And I can't say enough about the guy. And the movie is going to be just absolutely phenomenal. It's a documentary, not necessarily a movie, but it's phenomenal, which we already go watch that other episode because that was a great episode.
Absolutely.
But when you piece all this together and you come up with, you know, with a full picture, we're trying to get the biggest, fullest picture of what actually happened. And now here we are at the tail end. Just when we thought everything was done, the documentaries in the can were done, we actually pulled the documentary back out of the can because this was too big.
Kind of thank God for COVID. I know he was just blasting out on social media yesterday about like, well, one more film premiere down. Was supposed to be at another show, you know, and like I'm number four in the country for documentaries with stuff like this right now, like number one.
Absolutely.
But it can't be seen at most places because the places are closed. But at the same time, good deal, because y'all do get to update it with this information.
Important. So it hasn't officially been released right now. We're kind of, because you kind of have to get it through the film festivals first, so it's not that you're going to go back and just rewrite the thing if you got whatever. But guess what? Go look at what Rotten Tomatoes had to say about it.
Yeah.
Go look at Forbes magazine. Dude, the first Forbes article about this documentary is Forbes magazine.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many documentaries can say the first thing that was written about you? You know, it's normally in some obscure, you know, film magazine somewhere or whatever. Like, oh, this up-and-coming director, Lens. Blah, blah, blah. No, this is Forbes magazine. Yeah. I mean, come on.
I was covered in Lens this last month. You know?
Amazing.
Magazine. I don't mean to rough on them.
You have to come up with some, you know, made-up name like Wackadoodle Times or Nutters or Us or something like that. Yeah. So we have, you know, you have all of these things, and you start looking at it. Now we're at the tail end of this, and I start looking back and going, man, this is history. This is something that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, people are going to be reading about this, and they're going to research this, and they're going to go back, and they're going to see all of the things that everyone went through, the director, the survivors, the families of the victims. Everybody associated with this case has gone through hell. But what's weird is when you think about this, in this case, there was winners and losers, okay? And you would think that the survivors and the families of the victims would be the winners here. And in my opinion, they're really not. This they didn't get enough money. A lot of things didn't change. The security didn't change, as I proved by going back to Mandalay Bay. Oh, I have never, ever been stopped from going up the service elevators at Mandalay Bay, ever. Out of 50-some-odd times over a period of 2 years, have I never been stopped. I've never been stopped.
Never been stopped in any hotel in Vegas in a security elevator.
No. Even the Wynn. You know, when he came on there and said, no one has ever come into a Wynn facility and went up the service elevator without security. I was like, really?
Okay.
That's a challenge. Here I go.
and up you went.
I went. I go to the Wynn and I go through all three of his service elevators. I was lost for a little bit. And then I get a phone call from their security. Mr. Carver, it's a girl that called me. I'm not going to say her name. And I shouldn't be facetious about a female voice. Yeah. But Mr. Carver, we just want to let you know that you were banned from Wynn casinos for life. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, thank you. I said, well, would you like me to tell you how I was able to bypass your security and go through every facet of your casino? I could have probably ended up in the money cage if I wanted to. Would you like me to explain to you how I did that? No, not really.
Next to it.
I
worked in a casino. You ain't getting in without that badge. But that's a key badge. You ain't getting in without it. Yeah. But you could definitely get outside that door.
Yep. Oh, and I even took a girl that worked at Caesars. I took a girl that worked at Caesars with me to the service elevators at Mandalay Bay, and I hit the wrong floor. We got out on the floor, and here's how I can prove that I was there. They label the floors when you're on where the offices are and the money cages and all of the different stuff. They name them after streets. You had Wall Street. You had all these different street names is what the hallways were named. And so we get out of the elevator, and I was like, wow, this doesn't look like the employee, because I would always go in through the employee entrance just for fun. And
and
I came out, and now I'm in their corporate
15-inch office. 15-inch tile. Where am I? This is carpeted and nice.
Exactly. So, there's a lot of stories that happen on behind the scenes here, and there's a lot of unsung heroes or whatever. So I just wanted, I wanted to give a couple minutes that shout out to them. So I appreciate you allowing me to do that.
Hey, man, absolutely. Because I am so glad to have been able to have you and Ram on throughout the entirety of this, just following up on these things, talking about these things. I cannot wait to have him on once. The documentary releases, once Money Machine releases, I cannot wait to see the entire thing.
That's right.
Let's start getting
in. We got 2 hours to go. We can jump into 9/11 right now.
We got a little bit of time left, but I can't put it on the promo and not talk about it.
I'm so sorry. But I'm happy at the same time because this is huge news.
Huge news.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is huge news broken on the Dudes and Beer Show.
Yeah. Once again by Mike Turber. I think that's three now times that you've come and released stuff here before it hits mainstream media. So
we'll see. Don't I get the Beer of the Month Club
tomorrow? Well, due to liability issues, Michael, it's not legal to mail beer through the mail.
Yeah. Well, or at least not say it live on the air. I'll be hanging around for a couple minutes after the end of the show.
Hang around this time.
I will. I did. I accidentally hung up last time.
But starting to go into the 9/11 stuff, starting to get into... what we have right over here on the website, if you go to today's posts, are the interview from Lieutenant Colonel Stephen O'Brien.
You have that?
USAF 133 Airlift Wing. Oh, yeah, that is in the Dudes and Beer Knowledge Vault.
Okay.
Feel free to navigate on over to Dudes and Beer Knowledge Vault. And then, or Dudes and Beer /knowledge/declassified, and that is where you will find it. And this is the actual interview, at least what was released, what was declassified. There is still some redacted portions, apparently. I mean, this is pretty short.
I'll send you that.
considering the fact that this is what I was able to find whenever you were like, look this up, start looking into this. And that was the rabbit hole that I spent half a day in was Gopher.
I lived that just this part of it, because it involved American Airlines Flight 77 and all that. So I haven't seen what you have, so go ahead and go with it, and I'll try to confirm or what. I don't know about this report you have.
Well, speaking of American Airlines 77.
Dispatch, Indianapolis Center, did you get a hold of American 77 by chance?
No, sir, but we have an unconfirmed report that the second airplane hit the World Trade Center.
Say again?
You know, we lost American 11 through a hijacking. So
the actual tower audio.
Boston, Los Angeles flight.
Mm-hmm.
I can't hear what you're saying there. You said American 11?
Yes, we were hijacked. Which is a Boston LA flight. And 77 is a Dulles LA flight. And
that's the actual audio that whenever you go through and start reading this transcript, folks, that you that you hear about. And it was great to actively be able to go and find that, everything else. Let's start cracking into the case of Gopher 6, the C-130, the H-3 craft that was there, Gopher 6 being spelled G-O-F-E-R as in, you know, gopher to go get something, folks. And let's start getting into that a little bit and what some of the implications are with that, because like you were saying, some of the stuff has to do with the 1974 Privacy Act. Some of the stuff also has to do with Title 50 U.S. Code 3093, presidential approving and reporting of covert actions.
Covert actions. Yeah, I'm very familiar with that one. I love doing these shows with no notes. I'm just literally sitting here winging it. Okay, so if I say something out of whack here that
it has all the links in it.
But I haven't even been home for 3 days.
We did
a whirlwind tour, so I have no clue. So, so here's what I can say in a nutshell about that. Now, almost everything I'm about to say is actually in either the public domain or very close to it. I'll fill in the gaps of any, if your stuff is redacted, I can actually fill in all of those gaps. I actually had the original FAA transcripts from the air traffic control. I did put together a video that I will, if you want, I will release that video. I'll let you release it first if you like, where I put together the air traffic controls.
Oh, great.
Radar screen, so you could actually see where Gopher 6 was going.
Oh, nice.
And you can actually see Flight 77 come in from the left side of the screen and actually fly into the Pentagon.
Yeah.
So,
and
to be clear, there's
nothing on my document here that is redacted. It just specifically says that this is not complete. The report that I got it from was like, this is what has been released. There's additional stuff there that has not been declassified yet.
You have the commission version.
Yes.
Okay. So you see, I know what version you have. I have something else. I don't want to say it, so I'll I have to be real careful about that, because you already mentioned the Title 50,
exactly.
The 50 Act 1974, blah blah blah. Here we go.
On purpose I mentioned it.
Thank you, that was like my disclaimer. I didn't even know I was gonna get one of those. Perfect.
It's mine.
Everybody's like, okay, now Turber flips in. Now he was an investigator for Las Vegas, and he did the Tic Tac UFO thing, and now we're gonna go back to 9/11. This guy's all over the map. There's no way we can believe this guy. And I get it, I understand it, but wait, there's more. Okay, so Gopher 6, was the call sign, was the TCAS call sign for, the TCAS is a system that, is it like a transponder system? Everyone's assigned letters and numbers and blah, blah, blah. So I won't get into detail. I'm just going to make it very, very, easy to understand, easy to palate. So you have Gopher 6 that basically came in. When did they come in? I'm trying to remember. They came in from some island somewhere. And what they were doing is they were doing a flight back. They basically came in, they unloaded some equipment, and they came into, I believe, Andrews, They landed at Andrews. They were there for whatever number of hours, and they had a flight out the next morning. And they were scheduled to go out at 10-something, I think. So, but they actually left a little early. So they got delayed. They actually went early. They went, I'm pulling from memory. So they got delayed?
Yep.
Okay.
That's what it shows here. They were delayed by 15 minutes, which is why they had a rear end view.
Right.
Of the
craft. That was a 747.
They would have been,
they were told
that they were, quote, had they taken off on time, they would have, quote, been directly in the flight path.
Yep.
Of
yep.
77.
Yeah, because there was a 2-minute window that they were that they were in. Okay, it's coming back. It's coming back to me now.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I think just before they took off, they had a 747 that didn't clear yet, and some other stuff. So there's a bunch of little stuff that really is erroneous information, but it ties into this, but because of the time that it took to get someone on station.
Exactly.
So keep in mind, you had fighter aircraft that were being scrambled from different areas, and then up in the New Jersey corridor. That there was a lot of errors. If anyone saw the story about 9/11, there's so much stuff that happened behind the scenes. Now, I was not there. I was not in New York. I wasn't even on duty or working at the moment. I did get a call, and I had to look at this stuff after the fact, much like I do many of the cases that I get involved in. And if that makes sense, so I'm not sitting there claiming I was on flight Gopher 6 or nothing like that. Yeah, yeah. But here's where all this got interesting. A lot of people believed that what hit the Pentagon was a missile, and the problem I have immediately when I hear that is that people actually died. They died in the rings. They died in the plane and whatnot. So to me, when someone says that, they're not taking into account a number of lives that we lost. So real people died that day. And granted, just like with Las Vegas, there was so little information coming out, and all we had was that security footage. You had the most secure building in the world. I can't think of any building that would be more secure than the Pentagon, who seems to not have cameras aiming out the right direction. You know, and all we got was that little bit of camera footage from a parking thing, you know, where you had the thing, and that camera was designed to focus in on a car coming by, not a plane flying into the side of the building, you know, and that's why not a wide shot, and not even clear enough really, and I can see why people think it was a missile, because the angle that it came in at, a lot of things seem to be impossible. People say, did this impossible S turn? No, I've done it multiple times. Anyone can do this.
Well, and to use the actual eyewitness account of the plane hitting the Pentagon, like, these are the exact words right here from the testimony, folks.
Yep.
Miles played the recording of O'Brien telling Washington, approach or center, ATC, that's air traffic control, that the plane was down. O'Brien confirmed that he meant the plane had crashed. He acknowledged the choice of words made his meaning unclear. Then in parentheses, he added once before that he had witnessed a classmate of his crash, his plane on final approach. So he'd seen the sight of a jet fuel explosion before.
Right.
He identified the plane as a 757. He did not know what airline it belonged to. He said that it had a red stripe down its back and made a very steep turn at 30 to 45 degrees bank. And went on from there.
Right. And further into that, he was redirected to fly away at, the ATC turned him at 270 to leave the area. And he ended up flying, you know, he didn't necessarily want to fly through the smoke and what have you, but it was very clear to him what had happened. So Gopher 6 took off from Andrews and got airborne and was redirected after a few minutes. And what happened, when you listen to the, I don't know if your air traffic control goes into where I'm about to go, but there's a certain point where air traffic control starts contacting people. And one of the ATC operators is asked by another ATC, by like a manager inside the Enroute Center, or I don't remember if it was a TRACON. You have TRACON, you have Enroute Centers, and you have regular air traffic control. So you have one of the managers there say, hey, do you have a military? And he says, yes, I've got a military. I've got a, you know, a whatever he said out of coming out of Andrews. And of course, this is Steve O'Brien's flight and it's go for six. And so he says, hold on just a minute. Let me give you some information. So they asked, now this is this go for six. Now, just so you know, this is a C-130 Hercules. It has no weaponry on it. It's not like a fighter. It could have chaff or flares, but even this aircraft, I don't even think was loaded for chaff and flares that day for defensive measures. It literally is just a cargo plane is what it looks like.
Yeah. I believe that it had some advanced, defense radar things.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. The radar has the bubble on the front.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it has the bubble. Mm-hmm. We call it, it's like a long nose on the front.
Yeah.
So you have the C-130 Hercules. It's H-3 version, and you have the pilot. Maybe I don't remember how many crew. I think it's four crew or something like that. And now it's flying. It's going back to I can't remember the base. I think it's Ofut or somewhere. Or it was going to Minnesota. That's where it was going. I remember the state. So it's going to fly back. But during its flight path, as it's climbing in climb out. Now this is a turboprop, four turboprop aircraft. It's not a jet. You know, this is a turboprop plane. It's not incredibly fast and it can maneuver pretty well, but not ridiculously. But it was redirected. This manager says, hey, you have a military. Yes, you do. Blah, blah, blah. Can you redirect him to follow AAL-77? Or they just called it 77 or whatever they call it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, they didn't know it was 77. At the time, this was an unknown. This was a blip. It came on the screen. Transponder was off. The TCAS system, just to quickly tell everybody what it is. TCAS is a system in which you have a transponder of the plane, and it's interrogated by ground radars, stations or what have you, without explaining in detail. And it basically says, who are you? I am flight AAL-77. I am this type of plane. I'm going here. I'm supposed to land. You know, all the different information is just transmitted really fast, and it's just a very short blip of information, but that gives enough information for the radar operator to have it on his screen so he can see that it's not just a dot moving. It's, you know, you're not like playing Pong or something on an air traffic control screen. You actually have these dots with numbers and letters by it that tell you that identify the aircraft, the type of aircraft, the speed, the bra, which is your bearing range and altitude. Basically, it's just telling it's you know, where it's going, what it's supposed to be doing, whatever. So this aircraft comes on the screen from the left, and it's coming in. It's making some erratic moves, and it's descending. I think the original descent was at 4,000 feet when it was originally tagged, and was dropping. Was it? Yeah. So it was a little over 4,000 feet, and then Go for Six is called to tell this aircraft to keep an eye on it to see where it goes. So he's redirected, and of course, you know, once this air traffic controller has to clear all this other traffic. So this plane, Go for Six, flies in behind airline Flight 77, which they didn't know it was Flight 77, and is watching this entire thing. So this isn't, you know, he's looking at, this is not a little cruise missile. This is a 757. This is a large airplane. And he was asked to identify, can you see the aircraft? And he says, yes. And he's, and I'll admit that when he said it back, it sounded so mechanical that it almost sounded, you know, like it was scripted. And so some people said that, and I was like, yeah, I can see where you would say that, because it does sound like it.
Yeah,
and he says, what kind of aircraft?
Silver plane, red stripe.
Yeah, but the way he said it, he says, sir, what kind of aircraft is this? Because the air traffic control guy didn't know. And he says, 757, sir. And he says, 757. So he comes back, and they're repeating it. If you don't have that, I have the entire transcript.
I've got it right here.
Perfect. Okay, so now he's calling.
It's a summation on recording. Yeah. It's not the actual transcript between the two.
And I'll give you the actual recording.
Yeah, that'd be great.
You'll have it all. In fact, anyone listening to this, I'll tell you what, I'll try to find it tonight. If I can't tomorrow, I will upload it to 5x5 News on YouTube, and you'll be able to see the entire screen as if you were a radar operator watching the screen, and you will hear all of the
beautiful
every bit of it.
Yeah.
I think I actually have it on Facebook too, so just look on my Facebook page. I'll put it up tonight if I can.
Okay.
But anyway, so you have this, and now this pilot, you know, commander of Go for Six is watching this unfold in front of him, and he's watching this plane lower and lower and lower. And so he's being asked by the air traffic controller, what do you see? well, he's banking this way, or he's getting lower. And then he makes the call that I'll never forget hearing for the first time. And he calls back to air traffic control and he says, sir, the aircraft we were following has crashed, has, I think he actually said the word crashed, has crashed. And he didn't actually say where it was at the minute. And he says, well, where did it crash? And he says, sir, it looks like he crashed into the Pentagon, sir.
Yeah, and the plane was down is what they
said. The plane went down, the plane is down. And then he called back, he says, and he says, sir, the aircraft is flown into the side of the Pentagon, or however he said it. You have it in front of you. I don't have it.
Yeah.
And so that the air traffic controller now you're trained to remain as calm as possible. So when you guys actually hear this, you're going to think that this air traffic controller is like a robot, because he actually says, okay, thank you for that. Go for six. And he starts going on about rerouting traffic away from the Pentagon. And this guy needs an award himself because he held it together.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know if I wouldn't say save whatever, but I can say this: for someone to sit there, when you know that a plane with hundreds of, a hundred or so people, and who knows what's happened on the ground, has just flown into the Pentagon. And now you know that World Trade Center 1 was hit, and 2, and now you've got this other plane that you have 11 or I think it was 11 to 16 planes in the sky that they can't account for. And so they're trying to quickly do all this and at the same time remain composure. And then one of your planes on your radar screen has just flown into the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Yeah. At first they thought it was going to the White House. And that's when the White House scrambled and everybody had to leave there and all this other stuff happened. And the president was, not there. Obviously the president was in Florida at the time. And, he went to your state of Louisiana for a little bit. I don't know if you know that or not. But yeah, he went there. And that all happened and that's it. So whenever you see someone out there and they say, oh, it was a missile that hit and all this other stuff, all you have to do is look at them and say, go for six. That's all you need to remember. Just say go for six, and then they can go right. These are real people, folks. That this event really happened, and it's really sad. And this pilot has to live with the fact that he was following this whole thing and had to watch it go down right into there. I never met the pilot. I wanted to meet the pilot. I reached out to somebody at Andrews, I think, to just find out where his base of record was, but I've never met the guy, but I would love to.
Yeah.
But crazy time.
Yeah. And just to know that this stuff is coming out now, like you were saying, there's still things coming out, about 9/11 and let's go a little bit real quick, into the 1974 Privacy Act and Title 50. like we were saying, because that's a big, big reason why a lot of this stuff hadn't come out yet. I mean, there's even news articles that have come out just here in the last week or so about additional Saudi ties, all kinds of stuff.
Omar. Mm-hmm. What happened recently, I'm actually also familiar with. And trying to think of how I can say some of this. Omar al-Bayoumi is the person who was of interest, and that information leaked out back in May of this, not May, it was April, I think, April of this year, because we're in May. I'll wake up in a minute. The FBI actually filed a report, and in that report, they filed a motion or whatever it was that they filed. And in that motion, a certain name of a certain individual, obviously Omar al-Bayoumi, was in there, and his information was not redacted. As everyone remembers, when 9/11 happened, there was a lot of concern, a lot of question, and Johnny Hoover, if you're out there listening to me, and Jason Goodman, you can eat my lunch on this one because you lost, I win. Here's the deal. This guy... There was supposedly a connection between Saudi Arabia and 9/11 that no one could put together.
Yeah.
Everyone probably remembers when a certain few reports came out, they actually redacted part of it that would show that there was a Saudi connection. And that was done for a reason. the reason why it was done. You know, they'll tell you this straight up, because this is not part of the 74 Act or the Clandestine Act or the Covert Action Act or any of this stuff. The reason why that was done was simple. Saudi Arabia is our number one customer when it comes to defense products. You can look it up. And most, they buy so much that they have become a wonderful, wonderful ally. But at the same time, there's also a lot of issues with Saudi Arabia. Their laws, Sharia law, and some of these other things. You know, somebody does something wrong, they cut off their arm, or they behead people in the middle of the streets. All of these different things that I don't want to get into there because that goes political. But at the same time, you have to look at this from a political standpoint, in that this information that comes out now, 19 years after the fact, after everything had happened, and this connection. Now, this guy, Omar al-Bayoumi, has a, I'm pulling from memory again, but this guy had a notebook in which he was drawing the flight pattern that he would have, or that the pilots would have to do to fly into the building. Now, his involvement is, my understanding, because I have to like the plausible deniability, like I actually know something here. This guy's involvement was that he basically funneled money into the group of guys that flew the plane, gave him a place to live and all this other stuff. And where did this happen? San Diego, place I was just at over this weekend. And a certain FBI agent actually had stayed on the case for a long time. I do not know this FBI agent. I'm not going to claim that I know him or anything like that, but I have actually followed what he was done a little bit. And he stayed on the case well after everyone got off. And the FBI recently filed that motion. And in that motion, or whatever it was, Omar al-Bayoumi was, his information was not redacted, and it was a huge, this is huge. This is, I don't think it's as big as Las Vegas huge as far as just releasing this guy's name, but overall this could impact world events for a while.
Yeah.
But this guy was a Saudi Arabian who worked in, I believe, the embassy, and the issue with this is that from the very beginning, it was repeatedly stated that this individual, or not even this individual, but Saudi Arabia had nothing to do with 9/11. Well, they did. It may not have been at the highest levels of government. It may not have been specific individuals that we all know. Like, we can name certain, you know, certain Saudi princes. We can name Saudi kings and things of this nature. And so trying to tie this particular individual to any one of them would be a stretch. And of course, people think Saudi Arabia had something to do with Las Vegas as well. So, you know, this kind of ties into the overall theme of tonight's show. But in this particular instance, this guy, Omar al-Bayoumi, he was, in fact, directly involved in 9/11. He did try to find these guys places to live. He funneled the money. He did all kinds of things. He also helped orchestrate or plan their flight, because these guys came over here to take flight lessons. You know, we trained these guys how to fly planes, and then they flew our planes into our buildings.
Yeah.
But we're still a wonderful country, and there's, you know, all of the things that go along with being an American citizen and being patriotic and all this other stuff that we could talk about. But in reality, we sometimes have policies and procedures that are in place that allow people to slip through the cracks and do the things that they've done. Right. Creating terrorist attacks that affect our citizens, terrorist attacks that affect other citizens around the world.
Yep.
And we have the largest intelligence gathering organizations in the world. The NSA is obviously the biggest of all.
Hey, I mean, the first World Trade Center bombing that was, quote, considered a failure.
It was.
Considered a botch job. Like, those two bombers were FBI informants exclusively on different cases that were introduced to each other.
Yep.
Just to see and that was extra intelligence they could garner.
Right. And that was also, yeah. And you know who paid for that? Osama bin Laden.
Yep.
The same guy. He was so pissed off that he couldn't blow up the building the first time that he came back and decided that he would hire, you know, Al Saeed and all these other people that could make, that could plan it differently. And they did, you know, they figured out how to do it. But yeah, I mean, you know, so the Osama bin Laden, the OBL task force was put together as part of JSOC, which is a, you know, Joint Special Operations Command, and that whole area was you had the intelligence gathering side, and then you had the FBI, which, you know, they screw up a lot. So a lot of the intelligence was gathered and put in the hands of the powers that were supposed to make the decisions to save our citizens, and they screwed up. And you know it, I know it. Me and you may not agree on 100% of everything about this case, but in reality, we're both on the same side of the fence, and we both know that we were hoodwinked. Our government had the ability to stop these things from happening in a snafu in how the intelligence was moved interagency between different organizations was not handled properly. But at the same time, at that point in time, there was an internet that was going. They have an internal internet there, and this is before Google. So, but they have it now. That actually this internal thing that acts like Google, where they can search things and do things internally. I think Google told them to get their protocol out of there because they made it look too much like Google, so that people think Google actually set it up. But you know who the largest actual contractor is for the United States government that holds a lot of our secret information? You're gonna die when you hear this. It's Amazon.
I was gonna say,
it's Amazon
in their cloud.
Yep, in Amazon's cloud. So, you know, a lot of the government stuff is being pushed over to the private sector, which in a lot of ways it should. But but I'm not saying that Amazon holds NSA level information, but they hold a huge amount. And I'm not saying it's even wrong, because sometimes private contractors can do the job better than the government. I don't think anybody would argue that.
Well, I think that they can do it a whole lot faster than the government. And the difference is, as we both know, and anybody who does a little research can find out, the whole reasoning behind doing that and doing things through private contractors is because then any technology can then be through patented, all that kind of stuff. It can be reversed applied. It can be put into other fields. It can be monetized through other means, through those shell companies, black projects, things like that. And it can go toward other research doing the same thing. And it's basically a self-sustaining cycle that every once in a while gets to increase its budget by a few trillion. You know, and if you really want some information, folks, like I was saying, go check out the documents that we have in the episode post for tonight on the declassified page and stuff like that. But to go and actually start reading Title 50 and find out what the president has to do in order to have a covert action, in order to make a covert action happen, to go and read the document that we put up in the Knowledge Vault that is the covert action and clandestine activities of the intelligence community brief from 2019. Like, it's about as recent as you can get about operational preparedness of the environment, sensitive military operations, other than routine support. That's an interesting way to put something.
Exactly.
I'm going to start pricing a service on my website called Other Than Routine Support. That's a double time charge, my friend, at a full day rate.
Absolutely.
That is other than routine support.
Quite a bit. Yeah, there's a lot of things that go on. It's so weird, because there's so much I can't talk about for obvious reasons.
Yes, because 1974's Privacy Act.
Yeah, that's part of it. But then somebody Yahoo could come up and say, well, you know, anybody can hide behind that and just say blah blah blah. You know, like the old saying, "If I told you, I'd have to kill you" and stuff like that. But that's not it, guys. There's true, real people that work, that have done a lot of work in the intelligence community, and I'm just probably a peon when you compare it to some of these people. And when you look at some of the stuff that's gone on over time, and the ongoing investigations that we all thought were over. If everyone knows, if the government tells you something, take it with a grain of salt, because You remember when the Patriot Act went away? We knew damn well that that was not going away. They're just going to rebrand it something else. Right. We knew when Edward Snowden leaked all of those documents and a certain organization that I know exactly, a certain organization I know very well called Tailored Access Operations was basically relabeled something else. I think they call it just Electronic Operations now. I mean, they actually simplified it. Yeah. So you have all of these different things that have just been rebranded and relabeled. And that circles me right back to the Tic Tac, because you remember, you don't want to say UFO because that immediately makes people think aliens and stuff like that. That's so right. It has a special category. And that is true, that if you went out and said, hey, what is a UFO, to 100 people, 95 of those people would say that's an advanced craft, unidentified craft from an alien from another planet. You know, that'd be the thought process. But if you said, what's a UAP? They're going to be like, what? Yeah. So what the government does periodically, and it's for all of you guys out there that do FOIA requests, let me explain. Let me give you a little, I'm going to give you a little secret about the government. I'm probably going to get a phone call tomorrow. Here you go. If you're going to FOIA the government, do not specifically, or do not be too specific. Be specific, but not specific. And here's why. If you FOIA the government and you say, hey, I would like all references to UFOs in regards to the 2004, November 14th, Nimitz encounter event that happened off the coast of San Diego, blah, 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 right? If you do that, then what's going to happen is they're going to come back and they're going to say, we do not have any reports of UFOs off the coast of San Diego back in 2004 around November 14th as it regards to the Nimitz, because they rebranded it UAP.
That's right. It has a new military designation.
Right.
So if it was reported by anybody, be it civilian or what have you, mainly commercial civilian.
Right.
But yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So now you wouldn't even ask about UAPs, because there might be some internal documentation, hint, hint, that actually has relabeled it into yet another category. So, and you don't need to know that category. What you need to do is be slightly ambiguous and slightly vague. So when you send in a FOIA request, you say, do you have any information about any object, whether it flies in space, in air, or underwater, that could be associated with an event that occurred off of the coast of San Diego on November 14th of 2004. It's something along those lines. That's kind of how you want to do it.
Yeah.
And then you can do multiple requests.
Objects noticed during a military exercise.
Yes, and I see anomalous objects all the time, but they're not UFOs or anything like that. It's just things I just happen to see because I'm delusional and all the above.
Yeah.
I need to be delusional right now. God, somebody bring me a drink. I mean, there's just so much that goes on in our government that it's so huge and so vast and so many things that even internal to the government, they don't even know how to respond to stuff. This poor woman, Sue Goh, she's the woman that has been tasked for the DOD to actually handle all the information as it relates to Tic Tac and how. And I say Tic Tac because that's just one event. That's the San Diego event, because the Roosevelt event is a whole. Yep. Different scenario. That's gimbal and go fast.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, even looking here at the this is the IC-21 Intelligence Community in the 21st Century Staff Study, Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence from the House of Representatives, 104th Congress, and even right here, you can see, folks, on screen where it says specifically, the clandestine service should have organic to it the administrative and technical support mechanisms that are critical to its unique functions and essential to its success. That is as vaguely written in legalese to say they need unfettered access to do whatever the hell they need to do to get the job done,
right?
As you can get.
Right. That is fine. And there's more even behind that, because you have covert actions and then you have clandestine actions.
Exactly.
And so they're two different things, and they sometimes overlap, sometimes they don't, but there's actually a third one. But you have covert actions, you have clandestine activity, and clandestine activity has been pretty much been branched over to the CIA, and they get to do a lot of that. And then the covert action is more or less military.
Those are agents in the field, things like that, not necessarily a military action like an incursion, something like that, where you're going onto enemy territory to gather intelligence or to go pull a SEAL Team 6, something like that. Those are covert actions that, like it said in Title 50, are very descriptively laid out as to what the legal definitions of how the president can even order them go about.
Exactly. The president, his ability to order these things is limited. You know, you can't just come out with an executive order and swipe a pen and go, I want six guys to go take out this guy in Iran. It doesn't work that way. In a covert action, you're basically putting together what would be more or less considered a military type action, that where you're going to go over and invoke some form of attack or some form of operation that may not even be an attack. I mean, you may just be doing something silly like turning off someone's electricity for some reason, which we can do in Iran at any time we wanted to. And that was funny. I'll tell you that story later. So you have all these things, but then they decide, wow, this is a lot. We need to create a court that can handle this. So they created the FISA Fist Court with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance under the Surveillance Act, and then the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And then you go in there and request things. And I remember, when a request would go in, you'd have, let's say there was 1,000 requests that went to the court, and you were asking for all kinds of stuff, not necessarily money or anything like that, but just the approval to do a wiretap or the approval to actually do what's necessary to get into some cell phone over in Germany. I don't know, maybe like Merkel or somebody like that. The number of requests that were denied, say out of 1,000. What do you think? Let's say if we did 1,000 requests, how many do you think would be denied?
One would hope that 990 of them would be denied. But not the case at all.
Yeah, that'd be exactly reversed. It'd probably even be lower than that. It'd be maybe 1 or 2 out of 1,000 would be denied. They would just sail right through.
Yeah. Literally, they may as well have gone and like pulled their rules straight from the crucible and said phantom evidence is allowed. The specters made it happen. She's the devil in her. We need to investigate.
And the way they got away with that,
bends the rules. Yeah. And then they went and made it more powerful right now. And that's what's hilarious. Yeah. You've heard the episodes. I'm not saying that there's no COVID happening. There's horrible, horrible things happening. But good God, don't tell me that you didn't just use that as a distraction to just left swipe our constitutional rights to search and seizure and needing a warrant to get our information.
Yeah. You know how close this thing had gotten to where, remember just a couple months ago, we all thought we were going to go into martial law and all kinds of stuff. And what we're in right now is a soft version of martial law. I mean, we went through it. And so it's kind of like, it was kind of like the government getting their appetite wet a little bit. It's like, okay, let's see just how far we can push before we get resistance. Now, I'm not saying Trump did this, and I'm not saying Pelosi did this. I'm not saying anyone did this specifically. I'm not even saying anyone did this at all. But I know, I hate saying the word fact, but I'm going to say it right here. I know as a matter of fact, what I'm about to tell you is fact, that this was studied intently to see how the public, and I'm not saying they did it on purpose to see how the public would respond, but I'm saying that as this was going to occur anyway, you might as well put together a group of people to say, hey, let's watch this and see how people respond in different areas. And if there's certain groups that we need to monitor now because they're getting a little bit more upset than probably we think they should.
What did we say 4 episodes ago, Mike, whenever you came on about the raid at Area 51? What was my hypothesis? The fact that it was put out there and continued, despite how it started, it was continued as a means by which to get everybody of one thought into one place. Because just before that, the FBI said, hey, conspiracy theories are now a form of terrorism. And suddenly, you know what I thought? You're going to have all these people that believe in a, quote, conspiracy theory congregated in one nice area to be able to swath all their data. Because they're right next to a secure government facility where you're allowed to do it legally anyway.
Right. And you know, very well said. Now, I might have to go back and get that sound bite. That was good. Crazy times with it.
It's nuts, dude. To write this, like, you can't write it. You can't.
If we had Quentin Tarantino on one side and Stephen King over there, and then we had Tom Clancy over here, and we said, okay, guys, get together and come up with some crazy stuff, and they would not be as nutty as the shit that actually happens. That's why I sometimes look at some of these conspiracies that are out there and saying, guys, do you realize enough real shit has happened? You know, that you don't have to go off the deep end on some of these things. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. But here's what's interesting. A lot of people think I don't believe in conspiracy theories. They think I'm just a debunkering it automatically. If I see something, I just wipe it away. No, because there's a lot of truth in these things. There really is. And because you can't have half of this stuff be even believable unless there's got to be some truth there. So going back to the storming of the Area 51 thing, it's funny you mentioned that and brought that up. This weekend, I was with a certain director friend of mine, and we walked past a woman that was standing outside of a certain place and smoking a cigarette. And as we walked by, she had a shirt on. It says Storm Area 51, and it had this UFO drawn on it, and aliens like shooting weapons and stuff. And I chuckled a little bit. And as I got close to her, I looked at her and I realized that this is. I didn't want to engage her in conversation because it would probably be an all night thing. Because then she'd be like, "Who the hell is this guy?" And I looked at her and I said, "Nice shirt." And she goes, "Really, you like it?" And I said, "I really do." I said, "Not only do I like the shirt, I like everything that shirt represents. And I appreciate you wearing it. Thank you very much." And I walked away. Right. And then she looked at her husband and she says, "What the hell was all that about?"
That was the creepiest.
And if I turned around and
ever.
I told her, I know, if I would have turned around and told her, you know, all of the stuff about that Storm Area 51 thing and the behind the scenes things that were going on and me talking to you on the phone and just all of the crap that was leading up to it. And then, you know, it's just amazing. Me and you will have to sit back one day and we'll write a book together.
It really, really was a confluence of moments, you know, and whenever you start looking at things that have been laid out since then. Things that we talked about where, are they trying to just swap people's data? Quite obviously.
Right.
They must have had a successful test run somewhere because they just approved it for the masses. they must have shown its efficacy somewhere, man. It's mind numbing sometimes, where our rabbit holes go whenever you come on, Mike Cooper. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much always for coming on, sharing this stuff, getting into the nitty gritty of some of these really hard topics that are hotly debated in communities across the internet, communities across the world. Things that we are actively talking about and trying to shed light on in this show. Mm-hmm. So, thank Absolutely. You for always coming on and being a part of that. I greatly, greatly appreciate it, my friend.
And thank you for being the wonderful host that you are and allowing me, in some cases, I feel like I just take over the show and I apologize for that, but thank you for being who you are. Cause you and I have had tons of conversations obviously offline that just have gone into the borderline of not even bizarreness. It's just something that, you know, that we can talk at a level and know that the other person gets it, you know? Yeah. And to the people that have been watching this, because there's some people that watch this and they go to where you are, because you're broadcasting under multiple places, and they probably have asked some questions, and they think that I'm able to see them, and I can't, and I'm not seeing these. So what I ask you is to, and I'll try to come back and watch the show again, but if you do have a question that's specific to this particular episode or what have you, you can contact me directly, or you can re-ask the question under wherever you can. Until you get your answer, keep asking the question, and I promise you I will answer your question for you. Don't think that no question is too
good. I see them in the conversations or the threads on the Facebook group, things like that, I typically try to tag you in my response to them or try to bring them up to you in our next conversation. So... try to keep an eye out for that as well, folks. If y'all have questions about anything that you heard tonight, want more, don't forget, Mike, tell them where they can go to find 5x5 News. I mean, of course, they can go to dudesandbeer.com, go to the videos section where we have the YouTube channel of every guest embedded. It's great. But
appreciate that.
And those views all count for you, so, you know. That's what we do, but tell them where That's else true. They can go to join the groups to get the latest, everything else.
Okay, so primarily at the moment, if you you can go to 5x5 News on Facebook, which we have some stuff there. I don't put as much videos there because they get more traction, obviously, on YouTube. So if you have a question on any of the information you see here, if I may, if Chris lets me, sometimes I'll re-mirror a show and put it on there so you guys can
put them up anytime, buddy.
All right, I appreciate that. So we'll probably do a series like that. But anywhere you see me, or just search my name, I'm the only Mike Turber in the world. So anywhere you see me, just say, hey, I saw you the other day, blah, 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 and I had a question that you didn't see. You know, is it true that Trump is an alien from Zetar and comes here only periodically to mess with people? And I'll tell you the truth. Yeah, he is. He's a great guy.
Stop saying Zetar, dude.
I can't remember the one Bob Lazar keeps saying. I get a mental block with that. Zeta Reticuli. There you go. I got to like say that five times to myself. Oh my god. I got to go see him, man. The more I don't know. It's funny. But thank you for that. And again, I appreciate that. And let's close out the show. And thank you, buddy. I appreciate it.
Hey, absolutely, my friend. While you were online checking out the work of Mike Turber, 5x5 News, everything else, please make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast. That is where you can find all the episodes. That is where you can find our knowledge vault, where you can find all of the articles that we were referencing tonight, all the PDFs, rather. We will also soon have transcripts for the episodes. Just so y'all know, we are working in reverse format from the most recent to the earliest, simply because there's a bunch of crazy stuff out there. And we know right now that in the last year, we have some guests that have joined us that are hard of hearing. So that is why we're doing it. We listen to our listeners. If you're out there, let us know. Give us your opinions. If you have questions, come to the Facebook group. Join us. It's super easy. Dudes in Beer is where you can find us. Dudes, the letter N, Beer. Pretty much everywhere. Stop on by dudesandbeer.com. While you are online checking that out, make sure to stop on by our home network, HD Universal Network. That is where you can find all of our episodes. You can also find their great new instructional series if you're trying to start a podcast or do web design, things like that. Go check it out, hduniversalnetwork.com. Until next time, everybody, if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. And until next time, drink responsibly.